Okay, welcome, Rich Sienna.
How are you?
How you doing?
Good.
Happy Pi Day.
Yeah, happy Pi Day.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on my show. I appreciate it. And so what's going on? What's going on in your life?
So we're, as you know, I have a company that does partner relationship management. And we're in three different categories right now. We do technology.
Mm-hmm.
So companies like Microsoft used to be our companies. And we have a healthcare offering, and we're getting into the whole cannabis partner relationships.
What?
We're getting into doing partner relationship for the cannabis industry.
Wow.
That's the latest.
Are there legal implications that you're in New York?
I don't know.
And it's not totally legal?
Actually, we moved our instance up to the Canada instance for Amazon.
Really?
In order to circumvent some of the legalities.
Wow.
So we don't know how legal it is.
Well, that's I'm sure. So, I mean, of course, there's standards in the stock market for when something is investable for a particular mutual fund or whatnot.
Right.
Right. But I mean, I'm sure at this point, somebody's retirement is hooked up with pot. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, are they going to be, you know, are they going to be SWAT raids on old ladies? You know. So it's when it's got this much momentum, what can they do?
Yeah.
I mean,
like a friend has his friend's son does a lot of advertising mm-hmm. in California for the cannabis industry.
Right.
And these guys pay with money orders because of the whole banking regulation issues.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So they either pay cash, which they don't want to take, or they pay with money order.
Right. And it's not because it's illegal, they're still reporting
it. It's still a gray area. You know,
right, right.
You could get slammed.
But all right, I'm not going to be an accessory for having this conversation
bank,
with you, right?
No. Okay. If you put it into a federal bank, it's a gray area right now.
Right.
So.
Okay. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Have they thought about doing cryptocurrencies at all? Or
they have not.
Okay.
Not at this
they're
time.
Not, they don't have the skill set, or they're just not on their radar?
I think these companies are so hot right now. Who are doing the
right?
The
just whatever's set up, just grab it and run.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, they're doing a tremendous amount of business.
It is bonkers. So I was just my family and I just went on a trip across country,
mm-hmm.
and we were on the West Coast, and pretty much from the Rockies west, it is just bonkers with pot. Everything's
yeah,
pot, THC.
Yeah, it's all gummies,
CBD.
Are the hot
today. Yeah, yeah. It was It was interesting. I had to explain stuff earlier than I was ready to my kids, but I think they're.
So you told them, well, this is all the illegal stuff.
Well,
so
we made it into a game. We made it. Well, I'm like, well, technically, well, it was good. It was a good illustration of like how the law works,
right.
And like what's the difference between state and federal law.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay. So we made it into a game. Whenever we're driving on the highway, we try to figure out based on where we are and which cars are around us. When we smell skunk, is it an actual skunk? Or is it pot, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, my kids know that game now. I mean, you can't,
yeah.
You know. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a great thing because I think the illegal pot networks were, creating a mafia.
Right.
And that mafia is how people get other illegal drugs, which do way more damage.
Absolutely.
You know, so, yeah. I mean, I think... You know, advocating for specifically just pot. I'm just talking about marijuana. It's a bad team because you're giving people a dealer network.
Yeah.
To get heroin or coke or crack or whatever the new thing is.
I mean, it would seem to me that a lot of the people who are in this are used to be dealers.
Entrepreneurs.
And in fact, one of my ex partners is in Colorado, and her boyfriend has a production farm.
Really?
Yeah.
How's it going?
He's doing very well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, money is not his problem.
I'm in the wrong business. What am I doing? I'm just trying to like fix computers in the banking centric
right.
city. You know, maybe I should be out west.
Definitely in the wrong business.
Yeah, yeah. I should be in rancher territory, helping out pot farms.
Maybe New York State in a couple months, right?
Yeah, yeah. So
that's what they keep threatening.
So how do we even get into this? Oh yeah, we were talking about your business.
The business.
So, do you have anything you want to plug, or what's your business so people can find you?
We have a company called Guerrilla Tools. What we do is partner relationship management,
right?
For a number of basically for business to business communications.
Right.
So the businesses will use this. We have a number of large companies. As a matter of fact, we have the company that distributes Ubuntu, mm-hmm. Canonical.
Canonical
is one of our
fuck customers. Yeah, that's awesome,
and
man.
What they have is they have it as a partner network, so
dude,
that when they go out there,
you're like a whale or something, man. Yeah, you're a heavy hitter. I didn't even know. Heavy hitter coming to the Lilac meetings. Awesome, man. Yeah.
So the way it works is you as a partner go and register your deals and do incentive funds and all sorts of other stuff that they can track and help you with.
Mm-hmm.
So like when we did this for a large company. And they invested $2 million into it, and they made $60 million in revenue from it.
Wow.
It was phenomenal.
That's great.
Yeah.
I assume you're invested in your own company, too. You have a share. Nice. So, yeah, all right. You're my new friend. We spend some time together. Go out partying. That's great. So Guerrilla Tools is your B2B. Is there something else you want to talk about, or is it?
No, that's pretty much it.
Right. So I know you program, too. That's...
Yeah,
something
I do
different.
I do the programming for the business.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, we have a staff of 3 or 4 people, and basically, I've written almost all the code, about 1.2 million lines of code.
Oh.
In .NET and about 280,000 lines of code.
Wait, so it was 1.2
million
in .NET?
In .NET,
wow.
And about 280,000 lines of SQL in two different versions. I have Microsoft SQL and MySQL.
Right. What, do you use them in tandem, or did you switch at some point?
We migrated over to MySQL because when I go into the healthcare industry, I need everything to be mm-hmm. HIPAA compliant. So the databases need to be encrypted. So if I use the Microsoft SQL Server,
oh, you're getting hate. You're getting
encryption.
Hate mail right now.
Okay, it's going to cost me It's going to cost me over 3 years, $1.2 million,
yeah.
$1.5 million in license fees.
Oh, so it's the license fees.
If I go to MySQL, it costs me total with renting a computer to do it. It's like $30,000 or $40,000.
Wow.
So it's like there's a no-brainer there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I could see that. That's totally a no-brainer. Are you thinking about switching completely to MySQL, or is that just not...
No, we're going to run parallel.
We're going to run
both of them. So you got to keep... The drawback is you got to keep... First of all, your code has to be written in such a way that it knows that you're in one version or the other version,
mm-hmm.
which that we've got that working. And
right.
Then you need to make sure that, you know, the two databases are in sync so that you make update a stored procedure in this one. You got to make sure it works in that one.
Right,
it's
right.
It's a hassle.
Yeah, that does sound like a hassle.
It's a lot of work.
So what tools do you use to sync up your databases? You just do a dump, a live dump from one and then go to the other?
I only go from SQL Server to MySQL.
Right.
I don't go back.
You don't go back, okay.
Going back is more difficult.
Right.
But usually it's a one-way migration, and AWS has migration tools to do all that.
Right.
So the migration tool works about
90%. Stuff's up on AWS? You don't have your own?
I have everything on AWS, yeah.
Nice.
We moved from a data center to AWS, and we're saving like a third of the cost by going to AWS.
Really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's a tremendous amount of saving.
That's great.
And you can...
Is there anything you didn't move? Did you save a server in the rack or anything, or is everything in AWS now?
Everything is in AWS.
Wow, okay.
We even do development there. So you set up your machines, your terminal serve into an instance in AWS, you do all your development up there.
AWS is Amazon Web Services, for people who don't know. Basically, if someone's like, blah, 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 the cloud, they're usually, what they really mean is blah, 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 AWS, and not with a brand name on it.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, there's Microsoft has an offering.
Everyone has
a cloud
Oracle's
offering.
Oracle's got one.
The lion's share, perfect thing for a...
AWS still has...
AWS, everybody else.
Right. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not totally sold on the cloud. I'm really convinced that they're going to change their business model. And do you have an exit strategy?
We can move, pretty quickly.
Really?
Nice.
All your servers are set up with scripts, and you have the scripts, and
I can just move
the stuff hasn't drained out of your brain, and then all of a sudden you're going to be rushing, and
I'm not using
3 months later you still haven't moved. And
I'm not using anything proprietary.
Oh, okay.
So the only thing I'm using proprietary is I'm sending mail through Amazon, because that's the way they want you to send it.
Right.
But other than that, I'm not doing anything proprietary.
Right, well, that's because mail sucks, you know.
Well, their mail actually...
Just mail, not Amazon.
...has a greater delivery. than doing it ourselves, because they handle all that for you.
Wow.
So it actually improves the delivery.
That's great.
Yeah.
So this is a pretty hardcore project. What do you use to manage it?
It's all done in VB.net with SQL Server, and we've just, you know, figured out how to. We have one code base for everything.
VB.net, does that include version control? I'm not familiar with it.
I use SVN.
SVN?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Old school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it works out great.
Cool. I didn't know that. Interesting. Let's see. I'm kind of curious. So how did you get started in code? I mean, what got you into coding?
Let's take a step back a little bit. When I was a kid, I got very interested in meditation and in those kind of philosophies.
Really?
So I did a lot of research in there. I took a lot of meditation classes and whatnot. My father was was also interested in that. He had a psychology background. He was a digital engineer.
And Wait, your father had a psychology background, but it was a digital engineer.
Well, he became a digital engineer, but he had like an undergraduate degree in, you know, psychology or something.
So is he trying to write the singularity? I mean, what's...
Could be.
Yeah, okay. All right,
So I got a good fundamental education in electronics, and then I gravitated towards programming because I saw that as the machines are shrinking. As a matter of fact, let's use this as an example. This Raspberry Pi over here.
Happy Pi Day!
Almost everything exists on this little chip over here. You can see there's nothing peripherals.
Right.
Now, when the micros first came out, they weren't much bigger than this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They may be a little bigger. But the boards were this big.
Right.
So everything on the board is shrunk down to be able to fit on here.
Right.
So I saw that as coming, and it's like, you know, mechanical or digital engineering, I thought was shrinking. So I focused solely on software.
So was it just
software?
Was it just Moore's Law that got you, or was it something?
No, I just saw the software industry as being more progressive than the hardware industry.
Okay.
So now, fast forward, what I do is I merge the meditation into the programming.
Right.
Okay. So that if you look, follow any of the new stuff they're doing on what's called flow state, you know, like all these extreme athletes go into stuff, and they reach these points where they're existing at a primal level.
Hey,
to make decisions.
I'm a nerd. I'm not very cool. What the heck is flow state? What are you talking about?
Okay. So if we look at brain function.
Right.
What do we got? Let's use the blue. If we look at brain function, okay, you have from 0 to about 4.5 cycles per second, mm-hmm. and your brain is delta. Okay, from 4.5 to 7 is what's called theta.
Right, this I've heard before.
Okay,
yes.
from 7 to 14 is called alpha, and then from 14 to 21 is beta. And then there's an interesting...
So it's beta, alpha, theta, and what was this?
Delta.
Delta, got it.
Delta is deep sleep, 0 to 4.5 cycles. Theta is about 4.5 to 7, which is where you get painless dentistry, anesthesia, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Alpha is where you have 10 cycles per second. In the middle of alpha is where you have your dreaming state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you deep dreaming, REM sleep, that kind of stuff, where your eyes are moving.
Mm-hmm.
And a beta is your awake state. So if you're focusing, like if I focus on you right now, your brain automatically goes into beta because that's a focusing.
You're not hypnotizing me, are you?
No.
aren't we all?
Now, there's another state, which is called gamma, which is up around the 50 cycles per second.
And
okay.
Is that cocaine?
No.
Okay.
It's an interesting state because it's not, depending on how you look at it, it's not necessarily considered normal brain function.
Okay.
Okay, so this is like if you have an epileptic seizure, you're in functioning in the gamma level. That's what happens when you're flashing. Now, interesting, when you go into the flow state, you're in this primal level where you're accessing information from somewhere.
Right.
Okay? And you're able to make decisions based upon this information coming in. That could be, like for extreme athletes, could mm-hmm. be life and death situations that they're making. that they're making decisions upon.
Right.
Now, you can induce that other ways, doing programming and doing other stuff. But what's interesting
so
is...
So we're not talking about golf here. We're talking about jogging up the side of a mountain.
Anyone who's in a deep level of concentration where time is becoming irrelevant mm-hmm. is in a flow state.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that's typically thought of to be right at the 7 to 11, to between 7 and 10 cycles per second.
Between alpha and theta?
Yeah, high alpha, high theta, low alpha.
Okay.
Now, what's interesting is when you, just as you enter in to the flow state, mm-hmm. you get a gamma burst that they're trying to understand what that means. You get a gamma burst for like milliseconds.
Right.
And then you go back down. Now you've entered this flow state.
We've gotten a software update.
Okay. Well, something's happened. Okay.
Right.
So what's interesting is, if you know how to harness this, which I've done a lot of meditation, is I do all my programming in this kind of level. So I'll face an issue, or I'll have a new task, and I'll focus on it, and then keep on focusing on it, and then wait till I get to a state like that, mm-hmm. which is what I've done it for years, which I've realized is what they call a flow state, where time becomes irrelevant, and you sit there, and you know you work, and all of a sudden you see, gee, how did 2 hours of time go by?
So, okay, can I stop you there?
Sure.
And just for, so I actually have done some programming. I have an associate's mm-hmm. in computer science, and I've done some casual to moderate programming. I'm in the 100 to 10,000 lines of code space, not right. the million lines. But I had definitely done that. I have sat yep. down behind a keyboard, and when I look back up, the sun is down. And
right.
I went,
hours of time
what
by.
The hell just happened?
You've entered into that state.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, now you didn't enter it into as you're going down a mountain
right.
and you're about to, you know, go on snowboarding or something. You've entered into that state because you've had intense concentration.
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, the more complex the task, the easier it is to get into that state.
Wow.
Okay. So now what can you...
Assuming you're intelligent enough to do a task at that complexity.
Well, in anything...
Because not everyone is.
Complex for you.
Right, right.
Okay,
complex
so
for... Oh, so it doesn't really matter what the net... So you don't need to be doing work at 120 IQ level.
Right.
You just need to be doing...
It's complex for you.
95% or up for you.
Right, for you.
Okay, interesting.
So now what's interesting is that if you know how to enter these states, mm-hmm. you can accelerate your learning tremendously. So you can learn all the stuff you need to do with, like for new languages or new methods of programming much quicker.
That's really interesting.
And you can intuitively get answers to things instead of having to look up in a book, for example. Now, you still need a certain base knowledge, but if you know how to harness that, and this is what I'm in the process of developing a class to do this kind of thing,
right?
Where you're able to harness this and then accelerate your learning much faster. Like I did this all through college.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through college, I used a bunch of different techniques.
So then
and I would
you take just study for 1 hour a day and then you party the rest of the time because you
no,
got to your work so fast.
No, this was back before.
You just wanted to ace everything.
This is before we
nerd.
Did, before the kids today.
yeah.
Before the kids today, who spent an hour a day in college, including going to class. You know,
right.
We
right.
didn't do that.
Yeah.
But if you take a book, for example, mm-hmm. the theory is that your subconscious mind remembers everything.
Right.
Okay. So if I have to read a book for college, mm-hmm. for example, if I slowly go through each page and just look at it, supposedly my subconscious mind has memorized the whole book. Okay?
Right.
So now when you go to sleep, what I used to do is tell myself, I'm going to read this book at night twice. Okay? And I would have dreams of going through these books and stuff like that. And the next day when I went to study it, I would be able to go through much faster.
So you know
I pick up the information a lot quicker.
You know I have all kinds of crazy ideas on the subconscious mind.
Right.
And, you know, what you're saying, I completely understand what you're saying. I have not tried it. And I'm kind of like...
It doesn't take much to do it.
So the thing that bugs me about it is I've dreamt code. I got to that point in the coding process where I solved the programming problem in my
right,
sleep.
Right, and that's
right.
I do all my stuff like that.
Right, and you know, of course, we solve all kinds of problems in our sleep.
Right.
But I never tried to study in my sleep. I feel like I would be at the test and just panicking because
well,
my rational mind's not aware
of what...
It's not
the only studying you're doing.
Okay.
You're using this to enhance your studying. So you're looking through, you say, I'm reading the book.
You're studying the same
then
stuff.
The following day, I'm actually going to go through and read the book.
Oh, you're studying the same stuff twice.
So now,
once subconsciously, once rationally.
Right. So now I'm going through the next day and I'm reading my material and I can absorb it much faster and go through it much quicker.
Right, because you've already worked the concepts
right.
out.
Now, there's also a theory that...
I like that.
If you take a test and you study the material directly after the test, you do better on the test.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
As weird as that sounds.
Right. So is it, run that by me again. How does that work?
Okay. They've done studies where they gave a test to someone who they gave a test to a bunch of people
mm-hmm.
who didn't know the material that they were getting.
Right.
Okay. It was math or whatever. And what they did is they had them take the test. Then immediately after that, they went over studying the material so that they understood what the answers were.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did that, when they went back and graded the test had a higher percentage of passing or higher percentage of correct answers than if they didn't do that with the students.
Right.
Which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. I really want to try this now.
Yeah.
Is there like a book or a reference?
I haven't seen any books. I've only read
just try it.
On it.
Just try it. Okay. I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's easy enough to just flip through a book. Go to sleep, wake up, and then actually study the thing.
Well, there's easier ways to do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
When I was teaching meditation, we had some people who... What we would do is the class was like 40 hours.
Right.
So you learned all these different techniques, and one of the things that you got introduced at the end of the class was you got introduced to what we call your counselors.
Right.
These are spiritual guides. So we had a couple of students who were, I don't know what they were taking, if it was law or for something else.
Mm-hmm.
They took a test and they got 100 on the test.
Mm-hmm.
And they had one question that they didn't understand the answer for. So they went, it's called going to level when you go when you meditate. So they went to level and they asked their counselor, they said, what's the answer to question number five?
What's the actual process of meditation? Are they on a yoga mat in an empty room?
No, well, my definition of meditation is consciously altering your brain frequency.
So you're just talking about affecting the way your brain is
you're
functioning.
Able to go from beta right now into alpha within seconds.
Right, so you could be jogging up the side of a mountain or sitting on a yoga mat or sitting at a computer.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Okay, I got it.
Okay, so what they did is they didn't understand the specific question. So they went down and they did a little meditation while taking the test. They asked their counselors, what's the answer to number five?
Right.
And they said, answer C. So they circle it and they hand it in and teach. And he actually got called in to the dean's office later and was accused of cheating. He says, we have this question here, which is designed for no one to ever get the correct answer.
So it's a Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah. So how did you get the correct answer? Did you cheat? He says, no, I took this class and I meditated and this. Well, my guide said that this was the correct answer.
That's spectacular.
And they believed them.
Supernatural forces. You know what I'm talking about, the Kobayashi Maru?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So, in case there's one Star Trek geek out there who does not know what we're talking about, look up Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah.
It's from the original Trek. It's a no-win situation.
Well, except if you cheat.
I had a car named the Kobayashi Maru. It was abysmal. Unless you cheat, that's the only way. So you have to actually completely, not just think outside the box, but completely leave the box.
Right.
And throw it on the floor, rearrange things.
That's the hacker mentality, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You take the box and say, throw the box away and figure out how to get around it.
Well, maybe not. Sometimes, so some hackers, it's just a matter of, cracking the box a little, moving a couple of things, and closing it again.
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
You know, the real like the ultimate, of course, is throw everything on the floor and start over.
Right.
Right.
You're looking at the problem in a different way.
Right.
And that's what you have to do if you really
want to invent something. Maybe that's another goal.
Even in just programming or whatever, if you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You need to look at the problem differently. When I write code, people look at it like, first of all, it's very simple code. And I don't like complex stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I do it very simply, and the simplest is best. It's easier to understand. It goes right to the point. And I have these programs that work for me, and they take something that's simple, and they make it so difficult. It's like, it was so simple. Why did you recode it to make it more difficult?
Right.
It's crazy.
Do you think that they're doing that because they're learning on the job?
I think that's the way they were taught.
Right. This is something that actually came up in the last episode with Isaac. You know, they're just, it's... he was talking about code as just like building a brick wall. I don't know if you saw it or not, but and that they just you know, and my take on that was it just they just don't know how to build the code in the first place, so they're literally learning on the job as they go.
Right, right.
And you know,
yeah, they don't,
some
they don't,
of that is the speed of the technology itself changes, so it doesn't, you know, if the information about the kinds of structures you're dealing with is constantly changing.
I don't think that's the case. The problem is that they haven't learned how to design, because design is fundamental. So whether you're designing with C++ today or, you know, Python tomorrow or whatever, Java, you still have design techniques that you use.
So what do you think about somebody who just imports an object and just, you know, throws a couple numbers at it and gets the number out and never double checks it? You know?
Well, that's the world we live in. Everyone wants, you know, the way programming is today, it would be as if I walked into you and I said, you know, Matt, I don't like where your front door where it is today. I want you to move it over 3 inches to the right, and I'm going to come back next week and ask you to move it 3 inches back to the left.
Right.
That's how we code today. it's crazy.
Well, right? On the bright hand, on the bright side, you know, if you fail an inspection, you can change it very quickly. On the downside, you know, your house might fall down.
Right.
Right. So
that's how a lot of people write code. And it's ludicrous because there's no thought to design.
The way I learned it is this top down and this bottom up, right? Top down is what most people are doing, and bottom up, the most extreme case of bottom up, is improving through math every single possible problem, and then once you've identified that all algorithms work the exact way you think they work, you put them together, you test that out, and then you put it on the satellite and you send it to space, because if it's wrong, you'll lose the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I don't... Is there a middle ground? Is that a sane thing to have a middle ground? Would you want to have a middle ground there? I mean, you know, you can't prove all, you didn't prove all your code through mathematical induction. I mean, besides the fact that there's no one to prove it to, right? You're the one who is, right, but you have to test it. So what's the sane point of testing? When have you said, okay, that's a sufficient level of testing? Is it that do you approve your test suites and then just trust that the test suites give you the accurate result? Do you approve little critical pieces of the code that are using constantly? How far do you go? What do you think?
What do I do?
Yeah, yeah.
I try to break the code. But I'm the wrong person, because I know how it works. It's always going to work for me.
Right, right.
So you want to make it idiot proof, basically. Right.
Right.
So you want to try to do something that the user would do, you know, smack it with the elbows and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, like, everybody's an idiot at some point, right? Or maybe not you, but everyone else. do you have to idiot-proof your code from yourself to some degree?
The problem is
how far do you go with writing it,
I know how to make it work.
Right.
Now, the problem is you use it, you don't know how to make it work. So,
right.
You know, it's best to have someone tested it that hasn't written the code.
Yeah, so of course, there's this fallacy that you can stack up. Like, let's say a program is estimated to take 1,000 man hours to write.
Right.
You know, this is, you know, you're familiar with the mythical man month and the fallacy that you can, you know, just, we'll just throw 10 programmers at it and it'll be done in 100 hours, you know? And, you're shaking your head.
Or, we don't have the 10 programmers, so we'll just give you 2 and get started. So right away, you're behind the 8 ball.
Right.
You know, your project is already delayed by 80%.
Right.
You know.
Well, to me, in my opinion, of course, it doesn't hurt to actually write code, but you're almost like, you're just at the analysis point with that level of underage.
It helps to have a design. I mean, if you were going to build a skyscraper, would you just give a bunch of beams to someone and say, start building?
Maybe.
No, you wouldn't.
Not in New York City, I wouldn't. But
anyway, you wouldn't.
It depends if it was just...
You got to calculate snow loads and, you know, windage and elevation and, you know, all sorts of stuff.
No, I wouldn't do that.
But, you know, when you design a building, they come out with a design and they prove out the design.
You would only do that if it was a Hollywood set and it was trash. Basically, that's when you would
even
do
air designed.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
They may do the design in their head, but they still come out with a design.
You can't have a storefront falling down on $1 million actress.
Yeah.
She'll be really mad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of cool. So I, you know, you'd mentioned meditation to me, and I was just like, oh, this is going to be pretty this is going to be pretty out there. And like, I didn't know what to expect, but you know, now I really want to try this.
Yeah.
Because I've always had, I'm a little ADD, so I get distracted easy. And you know,
need to meditate.
I live at home with my family, and that's where I do most of my work.
Right.
And it's a fucking circus. I love my kids, and but they're brilliant and easily bored. So you know, we got the dogs are barking and the kids are screaming, and like, yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck looking down and looking back up when it's dark. So it does happen, but you know, it's a crapshoot which time it's going to happen.
Well, the problem is that it takes you 15, 20 minutes to gain composure again and get back into something.
Yes.
And you get an interruption every 3 minutes.
Right.
So how can you have, if you have an interruption every 3 minutes, how can you gain that 15 minutes back to get back into the state?
Those times when I really zoned out on it are sitting in a computer lab at a college.
No one
bothered me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the key was.
You got to put the do not disturb sign up.
Right, right. Oh, I have it. Well, first I had a paper one, and now I've got to a lit up one. So we'll see if that works. If not, I might have to go move into my trailer when I'm with a laptop.
if you don't want your kids to bother you, know how you get them not to bother you?
What?
See, I'm going to work here for 10 minutes. Call me in 10 minutes, and then we're going to clean the house. Guaranteed they will not disturb you for the next couple
excellent.
Hours.
So that's pretty good. I like that. It's evil.
Or if you want to take a nap, just I'm going to lie down for 10 minutes, and then we're going to get up and clean the house. You won't hear from them.
Awesome. So how did you get into this meditation? Tell me more about that.
I was just always interested in it. I found some books when I was a kid, like 8 or 9 years old, on how to hypnotize yourself. The other kids are reading like Nancy Drew and all this crap. I'm reading books on how to hypnotize yourself and how to do things.
I read economics books, but I also read like A Wrinkle in Time and you know things like that. So I was
I didn't read any
sci-fi
novels.
And nonfiction too.
Yeah.
So you know, one of the reasons I was asking about so I had I kind of like a weird background. My mom was a computer and business teacher.
Really?
So my introduction to computers was we borrowed a TSR-80 from the library and had it for a few weeks, and that like just whet my appetite.
Right.
And then she got to bring
did
home.
Did it actually work?
It did. I don't know. We must have been 50 on the list. I'm amazed it did work. But yeah, it did work. But you don't get to play with it enough to really do anything interesting when you have it that little time.
Right.
And then we got one of the original 5150s, the 80 the
8080.
8080.
Yeah.
Yeah. With two floppy disk drives, so it was the fancy one.
The big ones or the small ones?
The big ones, of course.
The 8-inch. I still have one of them.
Oh, no. The small one.
I have two 8-inch drives. The thing is like this big.
Yep.
Weighs like 20 pounds or 50 pounds.
Yep.
And it's huge.
And the keyboard you can easily kill someone with.
And the keyboard never worked.
Really?
Yeah, it was a Cherry keyboard, and it just kept blowing out.
Really?
Ended up getting a...
The clicky Model M's? Really?
Yeah. Well, there was a... I don't know.
Okay. That's really strange, because those things are like...
Yeah.
I had one. I think I still have one.
Yeah.
From back in the AT days. But anyway, so I got this, and like... I remember having a conversation. My mom is proceeding through college. You know, she's working on her master's degree, and we're discussing the meaning of business and what that does to microchips. And I learned about the compact clean room at the same time I was learning about, like, through. She had this, like, kids book called Umps Fwat. Look it up if you have never read
What's
it.
Called?
Umps Fwat. It was actually a business wrote a book for the purpose of enticing investors, but it's a cartoon book. So it's perfect for like a first grader or a second grader or something like that,
right?
To understand how economics works. And I read it and I'm like, okay, so that's what economy of scale is.
Right.
So I put the compact clean room on the clean room on the compact BIOS together with the economy of scale, and I went, oh, I know what's happening here. And I knew, even at that young age, as a little kid, I knew that the PCs were going to take over the world.
Yeah.
People had told me that, and I was like, yeah, whatever. You know,
well, when
people
I went
don't
to programming,
know anything.
I knew that was going to happen.
That's how I knew. That's why I wanted to know how you knew that was going to happen.
Well, you could see that at the time. And I've never worked on mainframes. I worked on minis once on AS400, but I've worked almost exclusively on microprocessors.
Okay.
So we had my father, like I said, he was an engineer, and we were doing I forget who we were doing a project for, but we had like an 8008, which is like the predecessor to the to the 8080 and all those. It was one of the it was like the first one chip micro that Intel came out with.
Nice.
Originally there was a 4004, then they upgraded to the 8000.
So your dad had one of those, or
we had the computer. I still have two chips at home.
Right.
They're
cool.
The little teeny things.
Yeah, I think. Well, now they've grounded the space shuttle, but they were looking for some. No, 286s. That's what they were looking for.
286.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was either 286 or 3. I think it was 286 that the space shuttle ran on.
And one of the reasons.
Well, no, they actually mathematically proved the whole chip that the thing worked, so they couldn't switch off of it because it had such a high standard we cannot fail. And eventually they ran out of chips. They had to buy them new, because they don't want to have something that's been already burned out and burned in.
Right.
You know. And eventually they ran out of new stock, and they weren't able to swap in new parts anymore because, of course, they're not making them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
So we had a computer system that was built on the 8008 with an ASR33 terminal. You know what they were? They were the old teletype machines.
Well, why don't you tell me? Because even if I know, everyone.
An ASR33 is the old teletype machines. It was a keyboard about this big,
mm-hmm.
and we called it a chukka chukka machine. So you used to hear the news when you were a kid.
ASR33. Okay. Cool.
So we used to go chukka 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 chukka, and it would put up a racket. I mean, you could hear this thing miles away.
Right.
So as you typed, It would actually have a little paper tape on the side, and it would punch the paper tape.
Really?
Okay. So now.
And that was your output?
That was your output. Yeah.
Okay.
So you typed your.
Oh, that's brutal. It's not just punch cards for input. It's punches output.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You typed your computer program on this paper tape.
Uh-huh.
And if you made a mistake, you had to jump through all hoops. And then
I saw people cry over and then dump punch cards on the ground and they went out of order.
Oh yeah.
And then you jump out of crack in the sidewalk.
So you have a two-pass compiler, right?
Yeah.
So you had to run the tape through twice. Once to build your symbol table and once to compile it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So
and then you could punch out your.
And you had one of these in your house.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we would.
I can see why you'd want to meditate, right? Go, come crazy. On, I can't think.
You
can't do my math homework.
Like 3:00 in the morning. It was insane.
Yeah, it's like exactly. Me typing on my clicky keyboard at home.
Yeah,
poor kids are trying to sleep, and all they hear, it sounds like machine gun fire in my office. I'm typing away. I have an idea.
That was mild.
Yeah. No, I'm sure.
So the when you had these computers, so we had this computer. I think they were doing a point of sale system for like a McDonald's or something up in Connecticut. Where they were doing a proof of concept for a point of sale system.
Right.
I don't know if they ever got the project or not. I forget.
Okay.
But it was something like that. Where when he first started with the micros, he was doing working for Litton Industries, and they had a contract with the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport when they were building it.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in the 70s, I guess. And they had, I think, like 24 8008s controlling all of the ground transport. So when you got on your plane, you moved from spot to spot. These computers would tell your plane where to go and stuff.
So I guess it was easier to do a business case back then because there's only a limited number of people who would even be capable of writing that program.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably, like, oh, there's only 10,000 people in the world who could do this, so
right.
That's our possible guy.
Yeah.
And these 9,000 are doing this, so it's only 1,000 people that could possibly compete with us on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not like now. Where, I mean, it's really everyone intelligent enough to do this is doing this because this is, you can get this for $25, so, and that's all you need.
And that's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
You know, that computer used to be, this big.
There's no barrier to entry.
Then,
I mean, you could buy a Raspberry Pi by collecting bottles.
Yeah.
In a third world nation,
Go to any 7-Eleven and collect the change that people throw away. You can
buy a Raspberry Pi. And it's a passable desktop. I mean, we sat there and demoed it as a desktop.
Oh, yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, so it must have been much easier to model who your competition was. I mean, is it like crazy to try to figure out, is it terrifying investing now? Because there's so many potential, without being able to gauge who your competition is, isn't it make you just want to go, forget it, and just go home and not...
What, invest? Or?
Invest at all, right?
It's a tough decision.
You just take the chance and bet on black and hope?
Well, have you been involved with VCs at all, venture capital?
Ancillary, not directly.
Okay, the venture capital strategy is I'm going to invest in 10 companies and one of them is going to make it.
Right.
So the other nine or eight I'm going to throw away, and two or three will be mediocre, one will be the home run, and the others I'll just lose money on.
Right.
They make so much money on the one that
was it'll make up for the losses in the other.
They don't care about the other ones.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, so that makes sense for a venture capitalist, right? So you have, because money's liquid, right? You have a pile of cash. You can divide it into infinitely small pieces, and then you break that up into how you think each company's going to do,
it's a betting strategy.
It's a betting strategy. You're hedging against the other losses. When you're investing your time in a piece of code, it's not liquid. You could take you a year just to get to the point where you have a good proof of concept.
Right.
And then, so you're those companies, they've invested their lives into that model, which, in fairness, we can't guarantee people success. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. But I still do feel bad for them. They thought, oh, this is the thing everyone's going to need, and it's not.
Well,
no one cares.
Interesting.
Or someone did something twice as good half the time, or they've been working on it for years and they didn't even know, and then it pops up from out of nowhere and they're dead.
Well, interestingly enough, what percentage of technical competence is responsible for building your business?
Mm-hmm.
What percentage? Take a guess.
20% maybe?
Less than 15%.
It was pretty close. That was a wild guess, people.
Yeah. Well, most people
we didn't attend the same business class.
Most people come out with a much larger number, but
yeah.
It's like less than 15%.
I'm a little weird.
It is your technical competence. The rest is your ability to market and sales and your ability to create a team.
You know what? I've just had too many pointy-haired bosses to know better.
Yeah.
Usually it's the guys at the bottom who know what they're, the people who are doing the actual technical work. And, of course, that makes someone who can do the business part and the technical part invaluable.
Right.
Right? If you have the social skills and the technology skills, but it's such a weird, rare combo, right? The social skills are inherently, you want to go to the interruptions. Typically, that's how social people are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the antithesis of writing successful code, as you were saying. It doesn't matter whether you do this, you're disciplined about how you do your meditation state. If you write code, you will disappear.
Right.
You will disappear into the code for hours. And I'm sure it's this way for some art, too,
mm-hmm.
And music and other disciplines, where you just whoop and you're right in there and you're just being a craftsman. And you're not done until you're done. And it's just the work.
And what's the problem with that? The problem is that you start to lose your social skills because you're focused on a computer. You're talking to a computer all day.
And the computer, so many scientists.
Right? And what is the computer is an Old Testament God.
Yeah.
It's either right or wrong, period. There's nothing in between.
Right. I will smite you. Why are you smiting me? Well, yes, it's very much an Old Testament God. It's not even at least the New Testament, you kind of get an idea of I'll look at what Jesus said and I'll see what I did wrong. And the Old Testament, you just don't know.
The Old Testament.
You're like, there's so many rules. You have 1,000 rules to follow. I've broken one of them. I can't figure out which one.
That's programming.
Yep. And you just got to slowly iterate through all of them until you stop being smited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge in trying to do it. But the problem is that from a social standpoint, you're sitting there working on code for 40 hours a week. You lose your social skills talking to people.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. And to get back to the point of what makes a successful company, the companies that, we've all seen lousy products become successful.
Right.
Because they had good marketing.
Or they're first to get the patent.
Right, but most of them because they were first and they had good marketing, more so than the person that had a really good product and they had no marketing skills.
Well, I can give you an example. Well, so I guess it's kind of splitting both ways, right? So you have the people who use the patent system, and they're the ones that you can have a great product idea, but it goes nowhere because the people running with the idea who now own it and know has exclusive rights to it, and no one else can get it.
Right.
So they do a terrible job of make a bad product or do a terrible job of marketing it, and it goes nowhere, even though everyone could use it. And on the other hand, you have the situation where you have an amazing product, a stellar, game changer, and nobody knows about it.
Right.
And it just dies because it needs a kind of scale for something in it. I guess that's the great part about software. Once it's written, you don't need economy of scale that much anymore because all the people trying to find bugs in it scale up with its popularity.
Yeah.
So, if you're willing to kind of go and wait to see if the holes in the code show up, they're going to show up at a rate proportional to its popularity. So you can theoretically get you're cut off of that. Mm-hmm. Like I have a perfect example when I'm talking about the patent thing. So I just totally aside, but it just drives me nuts because I think it was a great idea. I found this thing on Amazon. There's a company that sells a security camera in a floodlight. So you have to do is screw the light bulb into your old floodlight, and boom, you have a security camera, and it's on Wi-Fi. They're the only company selling it. And all I can figure is they must have the patent. You know, I mean, it's the only explanation. And everyone's like, yeah.
Well, no one wants to buy it.
Well, you know, it's a little pricey, but the real problem is you have to stream everything to their site. So it's lock-in. And there's apparently, so I didn't know this, apparently there's a standard for security software where there's a standard way to write to a security like DVR device through a network. So if you put it on the network, if you give it like a URL, it'll know how to write to it. And you, you know, maybe there's a key exchange or something.
Okay.
And like some security, a lot of security cameras, Wi-Fi security cameras will have that these days. It doesn't. It wants you to go to their website.
Yeah, they want to
subscribe
they
to a service.
That's why no one's using it, because they want to own you as a customer.
Right, and of course, and if it wasn't patented, you know, someone else would just go, oh, well, you just blew it, and make one without that feature in the software, but because they have an exclusive lock on it, it's a great idea that's now going to languish until the patent expires.
Right.
Completely the opposite of what your point was, but I just...
well, that's a different philosophy on how to run your business.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, I guess it's not obvious. I guess my point is it's not obvious how to, you know, there is a skill set running a business that is, it's non-trivial. I mean, it's another, I don't know, is a high-end businessman a technocrat? I'm not sure they are. I'm not sure it's that technical, but sometimes you just get lucky. Well, sometimes you get the right people, and if they're loyal, you know, if you can inspire loyalty in people,
you have to know how to build your team,
right? Okay?
And building your team is the key. So that's one of the key points is you need 15% or less in technical skills, a bunch in marketing skills, and then a bunch in how to build your team, and then you know running your business is a small part.
Well, theoretically, if you build the perfect team, you don't need to do anything else other than just make you know occasional decisions.
Well,
your team will present it to you in a way where it's a very easy decision. And you go, okay, I'll do this. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you have the right team, so. Treat your people right, I guess.
You have to know leadership skills, and you have to know all that.
I didn't even ask you. Do you have people on in your company for you?
We're a lean company. We have about 4 or 5 people that we're working with.
Oh, great. So yeah, so you definitely have that skill set. You know how to treat people, how to make them happy, and. You know, I'm not setting you up to get beat up when you go to work tomorrow and like, oh yeah, you're out there lying about us, huh? You didn't tell them about the dungeon. send help.
I mean, it's a small company. It's hard to to have a big staff.
Have the regulations got worse?
No, it's just you know you got to go out and get customers, and that's the hard part.
No, I mean it's like as far as having people in the company that. You know, having health insurance requirements have gone up.
Well, we're not big enough yet.
Oh, so I know it's graded, so you're below the grade where you're not big enough. That it hasn't changed that bad.
If you're below 50 people, you don't have that issue. Okay. We're not even close to that. But if you're below 50 people, you don't have the health insurance issues.
Okay, cool, interesting.
Yeah.
All right, so you got into meditation partly through your father's psychology stuff, and of course you couldn't ignore the computers, right? It's sitting in the background, tick 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 tick. And you got into were you into the computers the whole time? Did you have like a break, or did you?
I was always interested in it. I mean, like,
were your wheels already spinning in high school? You know,
my wheels were spinning. I'm like when I was a kid, you know, everyone else was reading, you know, detective novels. I was going through computer chip magazines going, wow, wouldn't it be cool to make a video display out of that chip, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice.
So I was always interested in computer, and programming came easy to me.
Right.
So like the first time I saw a program, I think it was a PL1 program, and I'm looking at it, and I immediately understood what it was doing.
Right.
You know, just by looking at the code, figuring out, you know, what the language was and everything else, and it became very easy to me.
Right.
And then I took...
Do you speak any other human languages, or is it just computer languages?
I got to a point where I could understand the news in Italian.
Really?
That's about as close as I got.
Do you think?
Well, I took Spanish for a number of years also, but I'm not fluent in it. I could read Spanish, but I can't talk it.
Right, right. So if someone drops you off in a Spanish-speaking country, you can probably find your way to the embassy or the airport.
Well, I used to be able to read it, but, you know.
Right, right.
But yeah. We were working on a voicemail project to go into Italy years ago. That was another project I was working on. And so we had, we were selling this voicemail to the Italian post office, which is the Italian phone company, which is owned by the post office. Mm-hmm. In foreign countries, for some reason, the phone systems are all falling to the post office for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So we were selling it to them. So I was studying Italian at the time. And trying to get through with that, and we were over there about 6 weeks a year for a couple of years, and so I got to the point where I could watch the news and understand what they were saying, but I couldn't have a conversation with someone. They said my pronunciation was great, so I'd say
nice.
I don't speak Italian in perfect Italian, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, right. Oh, that's I'm like that too. So one of the problems we had, people get insulted. I pick up accents really quick. Mm-hmm. So if I go someplace and they have an accent, I'll start speaking. So my wife was kind of joking because as we were traveling through the South, me and apparently my kids could do it too. We were all, you know, kind of drawing.
That's to do with how you tune your ear.
Yeah, we're just talking like this, and I was like, yeah, what do you think? I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. What are you going to do? Let's go over here. Yeah, that sounds good. She's like, I don't understand what you're saying. And it was just, we picked it up from the, and I can do a pretty good Indian accent, a decent British accent. I can read Spanish, and it sounds like I know Spanish. I have no idea what I said.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so.
You got to talk, well, if you hear someone talk with an accent, mm-hmm. that's how you talk their language.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's a strange thing. So I kind of had a question about. So I know you mentioned that you'd worked in finance for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you did after high school, or was there something in between?
No. When I graduated college, I was looking for a computer job.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine says, "Oh, they're hiring people in New York City for." I don't know, at the time it was a decent salary doing, you know, Visual Basic or Basic.
Right. Program. Well, I mean, it must have been extremely tempting to just go work for Wall Street.
Well, that's what I would.
In the 80s. I mean, there was so few, you know, it was just that 10,000 or that 30,000 people who knew how to do this.
It was,
and you're in the city that's the financial capital of the world, and you're like, oh, well, this is could be.
It was a wild West show. The stuff we did there was incredible. So I called up some headhunter and got a job working for a consulting firm in the city.
Right.
And I started off in some project, and I don't know, we were doing something. I don't remember what it was something for Citibank to do managing their traveler's checks in like Malaysia or something like that. So we wrote this program for them to do that.
Okay.
Okay, and then
traveler's checks in Malaysia. That's pretty specific.
Well, that's where the
right, right. Is.
So, I'm working.
And what
there.
Year is this? Because I'm trying
this
to figure.
This was like 1982.
Was NASDAQ even around yet?
Oh yeah, NASDAQ was.
Okay, so big. I don't remember what year. I know it was late 70s or early 80s.
Time.
Yeah, yeah, I was a kid.
So, so then the second project I'm on, they hand me a Lotus Notes. IBM PC had just come out. You mm-hmm. have two floppy drives. You had a boot and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So they hand me a Lotus Notes, a VisiCalc. It was a predecessor to Lotus Notes. It was still written by Ray Ozzie.
Okay.
They hand me a manual for VisiCalc. If anyone remembers what VisiCalc is, it's like Excel only. It was the grandfather of that.
Right.
And they said.
Well, I remember that Windows ain't done till Lotus don't run. So I remember that kind of joke going around. So.
So they hand me this manual and said, "Read it. You're going to the customer in 2 days. You're the expert."
Right.
So I figured out how to use it.
I am the system administrator.
Yeah. So I go to the customer. It was Spear Leeds and Kellogg. I ended up working there as a trader a number of years later.
Right.
For the same person I wrote this program for. So he was doing. He wanted me to write a spreadsheet so he could do. I believe it was the AT&T split at the time. So what happened with AT&T broke up from AT&T to AT&T plus seven baby bells.
Right.
I forget. I used to know them all. I forget what they were. So in an interim period of time for about a year, you could buy AT&T and you could sell it off as a composite stock. So you could buy the composite stocks and sell it off as AT&T. And it was all like synthetic transactions. But
synthetic transaction.
Synthetic transaction is an instrument that acts like a certain instrument, but it's not the instrument. It's just like a make-believe instrument.
Okay.
So you could say, okay, here I'm going to give you the AT&T stock, and now it's broken up, and now I can sell the individual pieces.
How is that different from like an ETF?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's smoke and mirrors. It's all.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because like that's the thing with ETFs, right? It's supposed to match the performance of the thing that it's tracing, but it doesn't necessarily have any of that asset.
Same thing. Yeah.
Like we've made a long series of bets, which we expect to act exactly like this commodity.
The difference is when they finally split, all those things that you were selling off actually got converted into stock.
Okay.
So that was the difference. It was like a warrant or an option.
So at some point,
you could convert that 10 shares of Bell South actually into 10 shares of Bell South.
Right.
When the split.
And who's the customers for this stuff?
So this was an arbitrage group. An arbitrage is where you buy and sell stocks for the company with essentially zero risk. So you put on a trade that has, I buy so many shares of stock, I sell so many shares of this stock, and if nothing happens, I make money, and if the stock goes up, I make money. If the stock goes down, I make money. It's weird, but it works.
Right. So arbitrage in general is like a carry trade. I know, like a carry trade is a kind of arbitrage. Is that what you mean by it?
Or? Yeah. So
carry. So let me just, because people may not know what the heck we're talking about. I'm sure. So carry trades are when you have two markets and something's worth different amounts in different markets. Mm-hmm. So it's a specific. It usually has to do with actually carrying cash across borders. So it's like a specific case of arbitrage. For example, if you were there was a big carry trade for a while in Japan where people would literally just put stuff bills into suitcases and hop on a plane and fly across because the exchange rate was different on the other side of the pond. And it was so different that it was actually cheaper. You made money even though you just paid for a flight from Japan to the United States.
Right.
That was one of the reasons they started putting cash limits on transactions. That happened around 9/11, so this was pretty recent. People were actively doing carry trades. So how does the arbitrage you're talking about vary from that? What's the game? I mean, it seems almost like Japan was manipulating their currency, and that presented the opportunity, you know, some kind of central bank faux pas between two countries was where your opportunity was and where your risk lay. So what was the risk in that?
So in for example, in the AT&T split, if I had what I did is I enabled them to just put in the cost of all these, the current bid and ask of the different stocks. Mm-hmm. And then they could see what the spread was. Oh, if I sell off all the composites, I'm going to get $10, and if I buy AT&T, which I can convert it to AT&T immediately, and maybe it's going to be worth $50. So it's the disjoint in the spread that they were looking for.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So like when I ended up working for them years later doing arbitrage, mm-hmm. and what I was doing was convertible bonds.
Right.
And what convertible bond is, it's you buy a bond, and it's convertible based upon what we used to call screw provisions. Because
that sounds like something Rick made up on Rick and Morty.
It's a screw provision. Because when the stock hits a certain point, they can force the conversion of the if the bond hits a certain point, they can force the conversion of the bond into shares of stock.
Okay.
So let's say I have I think Coors was a convertible bond at the time I was trading. Mm-hmm. And let's say a bond which sells for $1,000, which has a face value of $1,000. Converts into 10 shares of stock.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if Coors goes to $100 a share, it's going to be worth over $1,000. So if the price of the underlying stock goes higher than the face value of the bond, the company wants to convert the bond
mm-hmm.
into shares of stock so that they don't have to pay the bond back. That's called a screw provision.
Well,
that's what we called it anyway. It's the slang.
Right, the slang.
When you put these spreads on,
Heard office slang, never.
So I might have been able to buy the bond for, say, 500.
Right.
Because it was discounted based upon time value money and all this other nonsense. And what I would do is buy the bond and sell off and short the stock so many shares of the stock, so it's balanced out at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So if the stock goes up, the bond goes up in price. If the stock goes down, the bond goes down in price. So it's equal all
right.
the way. Okay. And then there's a pickup that I get because the bond's
you're talking about the yield on the bond, not the bond
right.
itself.
Right. So yeah, and that's a daily pickup. That might be $1.
So most people don't get that.
$1
yeah.
a day or $10 a day or whatever. So it's a whole formula you do because you have to short the stock. There's a rebate on the shorting of the stock, and there's all sorts of stuff.
Right.
So you put this through this formula.
So they hand you a formula.
Well, we had to derive the formula.
Oh, you guys figured out the formula. So yeah. you guys figured out the formula.
So what I ended up doing before I started working there uh-huh. is I created something called the Market Watch, which was the first one, and now everyone does it, but it was the first one done on Wall Street at the time. Had a coprocessor board in an XT, right?
Right.
Remember what an XT
yeah,
was?
Yeah, I remember what an XT
was. It was 10 megabytes.
Dun,
a whole
dun,
10.
Dun, 10. Yeah, yeah.
Like, today a floppy is like more than that.
I had an AT. That was our permanent computer after the 5150.
So. Okay, so this was
yeah, with, yeah,
this was with XT.
You're now in the space where I know what the hell's going on. Yes.
So we're now using an XT. So we put a coprocessor board in the XT,
mm-hmm.
and that read in a ticker coming in. So I could put 250 stocks in this machine.
Right.
And then I wrote, it was all in assembler. We wrote code that basically you could put in a free format text string and say IBM is equal to Apple minus Intel or something like that, and you could use that as your spread, and it would give you a number, and if it was positive you buy IBM, and if it was negative you buy Apple, and you go back and forth.
Was there any call from them to automate it, or did people want to make the final decisions on the trades?
Well, were you
actually trading with scripts and algos at that point, or was it not quite there yet?
No, this is before
this is just
trading.
Reporting
this is way before.
Basically Nagios for the market.
No, this was you had a number on the screen, and then you had to call up the flow broker, which we had like 120 buttons on the screen. We could call everybody. We had
right.
buttons to everyone in the world.
That's great.
And you call up and you say, I want to, I need to buy 10 shares of this, or we do a million shares or whatever.
Right.
Or 100,000.
And someone would allocate you the money, and then you do it.
Well, we borrowed money from like the Fed.
Oh, so you guys were just calling people on the phone to give the orders as to what to do.
Yeah, we were trading the firm's money, so we had basically unlimited funds.
Nice.
We had at the time, this was in, I guess it was the mid 80s, we were doing, we had $100 million in portfolio at the time, which was a lot of money.
Right.
At that time.
That's still a lot of money.
Today everyone's got billions, but then $100 million or $200 million was a lot of money.
Right.
We had a million shares of RCA long and a million
I don't
shares
know how,
short.
I don't know what like NICE was worth back then, but what was the peak before the Black Monday crash in 87? I don't remember. It was yeah, but a couple hundred million dollars was a lot of money. I'm trying to get some kind of footing here. What did Bill Gates buy Microsoft for? He borrowed $1 million, was it, to start Microsoft, or something like that.
Yeah.
So that was huge money back then.
Oh yeah, it was a lot. That was equivalent to like $1 billion today. I mean,
right,
that
easily.
Kind of portion.
Yeah.
So we wrote this system that does that, and what you could do is we put in all these bonds that we were doing with,
mm-hmm.
and as soon as the bonds traded in certain realms, then we would go buy them and sell them and do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we used to do portfolios where we would do a market basket against an S&P 500 future,
mm-hmm.
and we would execute trades of 500 stocks and. And we'd have to tell the flow brokers, listen, the market's going to move when you execute this, so just keep on doing it. Don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want these things executed. And the market would, you go home and you watch the news, and it was like, the market's up 10 points. Yeah, that was us.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It kind of reminds me of, people don't, if you don't live in New York, it's living here, at least until the 2000s or so, the stock markets touched everybody's lives.
Well, in 87 is when it died. When the crash of 87, the markets just...
Really? I would have said it kept on going through the 90s, that it was at least until the dot-com boom.
It wasn't as much fun. It was a Wild West show before that. When the markets crashed in 87,
mm-hmm.
no one was doing any more development, and it wasn't a lot of fun to work down there.
Right. Everyone was doing CYA and covering there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, but it makes sense because, you know, everybody, there had to be culpability.
Yeah.
You know, there were definitely companies that went bankrupt during that. So.
Oh, yeah. You know, you had to walk down with an umbrella so you didn't get hit by bodies as they fell out, fell out the windows.
Yeah, I think I'll leave late today. Wait till the fire trucks clear out and the ambulances. Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. So I know you and I had talked a little bit about Elliott Wave, and I know that you're into cryptocurrencies. So I kind of did a refresher for myself on Elliott Wave. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about it? I mean, I know you're...
I forget the numbers, but it works with the golden ratio.
Right.
So the golden ratio is like 3-1-2 and 7-1-8 or something like that, whatever it is. It's the same ratio that if you take a...
1.6 something to 1, that's what it is.
Yeah, I forget exactly the ratio. I have to look it up. But there's a specific ratio, and it's the same ratio that if you look at a spiral galaxy, the spirals go in that same area, or if you look at a snail shell and cut it in half...
golden ratio is 1.618.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And it's irrational, so it just keeps going.
Yeah.
That's
the Fibonacci spiral.
Right, right. Yes. Exactly.
All right. Thank you.
So what happens is if you look at trend analysis in stocks, if you look at a chart, mm-hmm. the chart's got, first of all, there's probably 50 or 100 different things that happen in the chart. You can, what's called head and shoulders movements, you have horizontal channels, you have vertical channels, all sorts of things.
I do some casual charting, so I'm familiar. I know the other day we talked about it, and I was just like, and I had a total brain fart. I'm like, what? You know, I mean, usually I substituted carry trade for arbitrage, so like I had to swap them back in, and you know, as soon as I saw carry trade mentioned in the description, I'm like, oh, I know what this is. So I knew that it was Fibonacci. What I didn't know was about the golden ratio, and that was that was what turned out to be the key underneath. But I'm sorry, continue.
So it I think it's like 3-1-2 versus or 3-9-2 versus 6-1-8. Mm-hmm. So there's these ratios. So if you look at the chart,
I'll clear one up for you.
So if you look at a chart, you know, the stock is going like this, it's going up, and then it goes down, and it goes up like this. So this is like a one wave, this would be a two, and this would be a three.
Right.
In the Elliott wave theory. So if you look at these ratios, and we used to have a friend of mine who was a brilliant trader, mm-hmm. had a compass that you could say, well, this dip over here is a certain ratio, so based upon that, if I flip the ratio over, it's going to come up to here, mm-hmm. at this point. And this movement over here, from here to here, indicates that this movement is going to happen. This movement tells you about this one. So there's, and I've seen these things work within pennies of what the predictions were.
Right.
So when you talk about the golden ratios, it all works out that way, and if you know how to trade, and if you're a decent trader, you can make a lot of money. The problem is a lot of people second guess themselves, because what happens is the stock moves up.
Well, that's
like
a problem than any kind of
and it comes down, it doesn't go straight down. It goes down like this.
Right.
So it comes down and it starts to go up, and they think, oh my God, I've made the wrong decision. It's going to take off, and it doesn't. So they get out of their position, and all of a sudden it tanks.
Right.
So, you know, it's like...
So there's a new twist on that. So one of the... Because everybody's trading on platforms, and a lot of people automate their trades,
right.
And this is something, you know... All right, I'm just going full conspiracy theory here. Because it's not really... This is the kind of thing... This is exactly the kind of thing why I have this show. And people don't understand, if you're not a technocrat, you don't get this. But if you're sitting there on Scottrade, or I'm not picking on Scottrade, or any of the online trading services, and if you're picking stops, you know, they have that information too. Now, they may promise not to front run you, but
It's all fixed.
They may not be able to front run you, but they know how many trades, how many stop losses there are. You know, they have graphs showing them the density of stop losses at any given point, and they're just going to run it right past.
Well,
a point of profitability.
You know how the stop loss works, right? I mean, I never use
explain it, please.
Stop losses. If I put a stop loss in, stock.
I'll do it in my head, but I won't put it on.
Right.
You know,
stock's trading at 100. I put a stop loss in at 90.
Yeah.
And you put, I want to buy it at 90. It's going to match, do order match, and it's going to kick the trade off, even though the stock never went down to 90. It's crazy.
Right. But if you're the last trade, right.
Right, so that it's like,
yeah,
I put the loss in.
I only want the other nine go away, and you're the next one. It's going down to 90 to make the trade. Yeah.
When you traded by the floor brokers, mm-hmm. the floor brokers would see that you had these stop losses, and they would just hit all the stop losses go down, and they'd shoot the stock right back up.
So it's so interesting. The technocrat, some of the people in the 30s and the 20s were calling themselves the stock brokers back then were calling themselves technocrats and saying we were in a technocracy.
Right.
Like nobody understands what we're doing. So they basically were allowed to do whatever they wanted.
Well,
Wild West, you know.
If you want to read a good book on it, read The Reminiscence of a Stock Operator by Jesse Livermore.
Oh, okay, yes.
Fascinating book.
Yes.
It was back in the 20s.
Yep.
Okay, and he ended up, supposedly he shot himself or killed himself because he said the market got dull, so, which is...
Yeah, a little suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Tesla, too. Oh, look, we just happened to pick up all your notes right after you died from your hotel room.
But
how convenient for us.
I'll tell you a funny story. When program trading first came in, one of my customers, who I probably shouldn't name, came up with a
euphemisms.
Pseudonyms
and euphemisms.
Well, they created a program trading on a IBM PC.
Right.
And they were reading stock tickers in. We were supplying them with the tickers.
All right.
So they had the algorithm set a little bit too tight. So what happened is the algorithm kicks off a trade, and as it's kicking off the trade, the stocks went up, I guess, because they were buying. So when it went up, it kicked off another trade before they got done with the thing, and it started selling.
Right.
So in the process of buying, it was also selling. And then it did like five of these. Okay.
Wow.
It got so bad, they had to actually unplug the machine to stop it because it was kicking off all these trades so fast.
Right.
And then it took them like a week to straighten everything out because it was such a mess.
Right. Well, I think that
it was like a month before they went back to do program trading. Now everything is program trading.
Right. The humans barely matter. The humans just put a vote in and the algo makes the decision.
I mean, when I was in the market, it was like 100 million share a day. It was like, oh my God, 100 million share a day.
Right.
Right now it's like a billion shares or something. It's phenomenal.
You know, I mean, I don't even think this is a conspiracy theory anymore. I think it's kind of confirmed. You know, all those flash crashes are just algos. You know, it's just algorithms.
Yeah.
They all made the same choice, mm-hmm. and they all panicked at the same exact millisecond,
yep.
and it just they all piled the trade on top of each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, when I was reading about the golden ratio and the Fibonacci sequence, so I'm going to do something controversial. Mm-hmm. I've been singing your praises, and I haven't really challenged you. But so I have a theory. So of course, for people who don't know, Bitcoin is completely changed the planet,
mm-hmm.
you know, already, and it's just starting. I mean, there was just, I don't know if you heard about this, there was a sovereign Bitcoin settlement, I think it was
right.
Argentina.
Yeah, you mentioned that the other
day. I mentioned that the other day, yeah. So that's the first one. So that's a signal I've been waiting for. That's a big one.
Right.
Because, you know, at that point, now they're a small country, economically speaking, not physically, but for large countries to settle, we're looking easily at $100,000 of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So if that settlement becomes a trend, if sovereign settlement becomes a trend, then... We're looking at another spike. So I have a theory that we're going to spike in the summer, and the reasoning being nothing more complex than we're just following the same multi-year macro trend in with Bitcoin as the leader, although it could change, but currently mm-hmm. it's still Bitcoin, I think, of cryptos and of the new technology, of this disruptive technology, and that it always does that. It comes down and it crashes, and then within about anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, it spikes back up. Now, the one exception was the most recent trough and top, the top of 20,000, that was a cup and handle pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever looked at a chart and noticed
right,
that,
yep.
but yeah, okay, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as soon as it hit the cup, the rim of the cup the first time and started, you know, lazily coming back down to form the handle, I'm like, oh! you know, I was like, all alone. No one else in the world knew what I was talking about. I'm standing up in my office going, yeah, I knew we'd make a lot of money. So, I did well in Bitcoin. So I kind of knew that it was going to spike up from there. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was weird about it is that whole, the cup was 3 years wide. So there's actually, there's some Elliott Wave guys out there saying that, you know, that this is, that the larger pattern is that these, now that each of the troughs are going to be substantially larger than the last one.
Well,
and this trough
larger,
is going to be 5 years long.
They could be larger, they could be smaller. That's what you don't know.
But see, here's the thing.
It's going to go in the same ratio, but is the first trough the small ratio or is it the large ratio?
So you agree with me about the final ratios.
The final ratio,
it's about 80%.
If you look at it in 10 years, you're going to say, oh, it was obvious it was this.
Yeah.
But is the ratio the large one or the small one? Well, that's based upon subjective.
The ratio has not changed. You know, there's a range, of course. It's not an exact number every time, but it's pretty close to, you know, it retraces to about 80%, anywhere from 60 to 80%, and then it spikes up
the question is
up to 2,200%.
Is the period the shorter period that we just went through, or is it the longer period we just went through, and the next one's going to be shorter?
So I think it's going to be shorter. Here's why. And, you know, of course, yeah, that's convenient for me and whatever trades I've made. So I'm trying to not talk my book. But I'm also, you know, I'm also being realistic about it. There's plenty of time to think about this. This isn't like a panicked thought. So my thinking is what happened with that cup is that all these different financial institutions started burying themselves into cryptocurrencies.
Most of them still won't trade it.
But they won't trade it. So I think that that was actually a smokescreen and that they were actually trying to figure out a way to manipulate it.
Well, they may have, but I'm through trading, you can't buy Bitcoin right now as from them.
Right.
So I can't put a trade in. Am I trading IBM and then trade, you know, 5 Bitcoin? I can't go buy it.
Well, of course, the oldest scam in the book is a secret ledger, right? You know, and Bitcoin's a public ledger. And a lot of the times when things are manipulated, there's a ledger that you can't verify directly. They'll say, yeah, we moved these many.
Bitcoin doesn't fall under any regulations right now. So.
Well, it doesn't fall under any regulations, but you don't need to ask for, like you can't, of course, the favorite with the gold bugs is you can't go in the gold vaults and look at how much gold there is. But I think this applies too, and it clearly applies. I mean, Bernie Madoff was the guy who made the NASDAQ. How can you trust their database to actually reflect how many stocks are outstanding? You know, when you can't even trust the guy who originally built the thing to even try to keep an honest book. You know, there's a lot of trust built into the system where the big banks say, oh yeah, we have this many stocks. Why? Because we say so. Can we see it?
Well,
no.
I'll give you an example. I had a customer.
Right.
I was in consulting, and it was a bank. And they get audited by the feds, and they were from something down south, Argentina or Brazil or whatever.
Right.
And that's where the owner of the bank was. And most of their customers were people who lived in that country who were hiding money.
Right.
And let's face it, what they were doing. So they did a lot of foreign exchange between, you know, for balancing currencies between all the different nations that they were doing.
Right.
So
Cayman Islands. Continue.
Well, that's another bank.
Okay, all right. Different bank, sorry.
That was a different bank. So the feds come in one day and audit them, and they're supposed to have $20 million or something in the vault, and they go down and it's like, you know, $250 Series E savings bonds. And it's like, they're going, oh, shit.
IOU.
What's going on over here? We got a hot one.
Yeah.
So they go up, and they're poking around, and the head trader who screwed everything up knows exactly what's going on.
Right.
He says to him, for immunity, I'll tell you everything.
Nice.
So they figure, oh, we got that. We got, you know, open and shut case here.
Right.
So he gets his little immunity thing, and it turns out he lost all the money, and he blamed the owner of the bank. The feds look like idiots because they trusted this guy.
The one guy that did it is the one they gave immunity to.
They find out he's done this twice before, or, you know, a couple times before.
Wow.
And they look like idiots. And then, meanwhile, they put the bank out of business. And the owner of the bank is in down Brazil, wherever the hell he is. And he's like, you know, calls up the feds and says, listen, I'm going to come in on my jet on Sunday and I'll surrender myself, because he knows he wasn't at fault. Mm-hmm. So they come in, they surrender, they impound all his, you know, $300 million worth of assets that he has. And two years later, they still don't have a case. They end up giving it all back to him.
Wow.
But meanwhile, the bank's out of business.
Yeah, it was just a big court ruling in civil forfeiture. Because it used to, for a while, I mean, I don't know if it was they were doing it back then, you know, because you said they gave it back to him. Yeah. But yeah, for a while in this country, for like 20 years, they were, you know, people would be accused of something, not even convicted, just accused,
right.
And the police would seize everything and they just keep it. And,
well, they seize everything, but I mean,
and there was just a case, and like it was either the appeals court or was the Supreme Court. I think it might have been the Supreme Court on civil forfeiture, and they said, yeah, you can't do that anymore. You can't just take it all. It has to be a reason.
Yeah,
yeah, it has to be a law backing it up.
But,
nobody challenged it for decades. So
he ended up getting it back, but it destroyed the bank. It destroyed his, you know, his credibility and
his reputation. He had what he had, and that was it.
It was really a shame. He was a real nice guy, and the bank was a bunch of sweethearts.
Just the wrong guy.
Just one guy was the wrong guy.
Yeah, yeah. So he conned him. He conned the Fed.
Yeah.
He conned the feds when they came in and with the investigation.
Yeah, but
you're totally right. This is like there's so much trust me from the banks and like what they say they have.
Yeah.
And also I think there was a lot of FUD going on around in the bottom of that cup. There was all this stuff with the Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash, and there was a legitimate hard software problem with Bitcoin, which was solved. But the thing is, it became so acrimonious between groups. It became somewhat acrimonious between the groups of developers, became more acrimonious with the people who didn't totally understand Bitcoin. They were just trying to follow along.
Right.
And everybody wants to pick a side and fight. You know, where have we seen that before?
Yeah.
Right. Everyone wants to wave a flag and yell and scream and run at each other. And so that caused the trough to become elongated. And this is important for a reason. So that was the only time it broke the year and a half mold. Every other time it was a year and a half. So if I'm right about that, I think what's happening here is, so there's a lot of Elliott Wave guys who are claiming, now I'm not saying they're any good at it, you know, mm-hmm. the internet.
It's not true if it's on the internet.
Yeah, it's always true if it's on the internet, claiming that it must be 5 years because, you know, that's the extension pattern.
It's great to be a futurist because no one calls you on it.
Right, right. Well, I do. I try to pay attention. When people are right, what's better than projections, right? If you make a prediction and it's correct, your opinion is worth 10,000 times anyone else.
I had a company called Bulldog Research.
Right.
And what we did is we analyzed stock analysts. So we would rate you as an analyst based upon how if you came out with your prediction quicker than the next guy and all did silly things.
Really?
And we found out that,
so it was like a bounty.
We had to be really stupid not to get one of our awards.
Wow.
Because it was some award you could pick up by just, you know, we had 20, 25 or 30 different metrics as we do. And it was like, okay, you won the award for this and you won the award for that. And it was in the .com era and it ended up going bust.
Right, right. Now that could have been, I mean, that's people, that's a bug bounty.
Oh yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, yeah, that's a valid model. It just, the .com crash was hard. It was it was brutal. lots of bad companies died, but a few good ones died too.
Yeah,
so
it was brutal for some of us more than others.
Yeah, yeah.
But the we were getting data from, I think, Ibis and First Call. I think Ibis was in the World Trade Center.
Right.
Which was sad because they got killed on 9/11.
Oh, were they one of the floors that actually had the impact, or
they were in the main building and they were gone. I don't know how many of their people were in there, but
right.
a couple of companies I used to work with or deal with were in that building.
Yeah, my wife actually a long time ago worked at it was just a clerk job.
I hated
working
that
in the gym in that building.
Yeah, I hate it. It always bothered me when you're on like the Windows of the World. You could feel it. I could always feel it swaying.
Really?
And everyone else is like, oh, it doesn't move. It's like, what are you? It was like
even in your meditation,
it moves like 14 feet.
Wow!
You hang a thing from the ceiling, it's swinging. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Okay. I never went up on the top of that one. I've been in Empire State and
Empire State.
I've worked in the Chrysler Building, so
Empire
I was up there
State
every day.
Empire State Building is a solid building that doesn't move at all.
Okay.
I mean, that thing is the walls are like 10 feet thick on that building.
Yeah, so many conspiracy theories. Well, maybe we'll come back to that. So about the cup and the. So I think that this was a one-time thing, and I think what actually happened is we had, because it took twice as long, because we actually had 2 1.5-year cycles in the cup, that was actually the reason, and it makes sense. I was like, I bet it's going to go up twice as much, because usually it goes up somewhere from 900 to 1,100%,
right.
And it went up 2,100% or 2,200%, which it doubled, so it was reflecting the longer wait period before it went along. So
I think... It's just been a channel that's going through, you know, trading in a horizontal channel for a while.
Right. Well, I mean, it just, you know, like looking at I'm trying to step away from the numbers and look at the psychology behind why... You know, that pattern formed.
Well, also, what you got to look at is what is going on right now with faith in currencies.
It's terrible.
So it's
tragic, and they're about to die. That's how
I
see it.
And the faith in the Bitcoin is like, well, is it really going to? Is it safe to go in there? For me, as a personal investor, it's safe for me to put my money in there because of all of the.
Only if you're a technocrat.
All of the stuff that's out there that can
totally serious.
Steal
not just,
it from you.
I'm not just doing the shtick.
Right.
It's only safe if you're a technocrat. I mean, it was funny. I went to my bank, and I mentioned I was moving some money, a trivial amount of money, into one of the exchanges.
Right.
And the clerk was asking me about, oh, how's, you know. I'm like, yeah, I've done crypto investment before. She's like, how'd that work out? You know, I guess she was, I'm like, if you don't know what you're doing, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble, because what people think that cryptocurrency is a currency, it's not, it's a bank.
Right.
So if you don't know how to replicate all the security structures of the bank, you're going to get taken.
Yeah.
You know, if you do, then you might be okay. You might also get lucky, but, you know.
I forget who was talking to the other day, and they were like, oh, yeah, I have some cryptocurrency, and it's like, well, where is it? Oh, it's in one of the wallet companies. What are they called?
Cold storage.
So it's like, why are you doing that?
Why? Yeah.
They can be out of business tomorrow, or your stuff can disappear.
And you know what? You'll get the money back. You'll get the money back in the currency of the jurisdiction that the court case is tried in whatever
if you go to court, the
local currency's value is. This is what's happening with Mt. Gox. Everybody's getting their money back in yen.
Yeah.
In what Bitcoin was priced at that time, whereas if they had held it the whole time, they would have made a lot more money.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then how much Bitcoin has been lost? It's just like...
They just don't understand arbitrage.
Well, how much Bitcoin has been lost because they lost their password, and now they threw that drive away, and they had,
That's a feature, not a bug. I mean, Bitcoin is... So people don't understand that it's a deflationary currency.
Right.
And that, you know, I mean, this is... It's inherently deflationary because there are going to be hardware errors where disks are lost and people don't have sufficient backups.
Well, there was that one that the guy had, I don't know how many Bitcoin he had, and he threw the computer away, and he's searching the dump for that computer.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing. So I've been doing multiple copies, cold storage, encrypted every time, and because what if a building burns down? I don't want to,
you know. What if you forget your encryption key?
What if you forget your encryption key, right, you know. Or you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, this is...
You have the St. Christopher medal with
we have
the encryption key encoded on it in a secret code.
Right. So, but like, this is something that comes up with families, you know. What if someone dies and the family's wealth is tied up in a cryptocurrency?
Yeah.
And they had the password in their head, and now it's rotting meat.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Well, you need the password on, you know, Medallion or something that's
right. You know. Stuck on when they're putting the pacemaker in, make sure to tuck a little paper in there.
Well, there was a movie like that years ago where the guy had the password on his, you know, St. Christopher medal, for lack of a better thing.
Oh, okay.
And you know, it had, you know, XII7 or whatever, you know, the Roman numerals.
Mm-hmm.
That converted into his password.
Okay.
That's why I'm saying you got the medal with the password on it, or
yeah,
secret code that your whole family knows about.
Yeah. So my wife knows it. I hope. We have a system. It's not foolproof. As I'm getting older, I'm starting to try to work the bugs out of it because, right. The odds are going up. I mean, I ride a motorcycle, so you can tell I'm extremely irresponsible that it isn't foolproof already, right? That came up a lot in meetings at work. I'd be like, this is not really a good strategy because I ride a motorcycle, so I may not make it to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you're putting everything on me. You sure you want to do that?
Never tell them that.
Never tell. Well, no.
It's not going to hurt you if you don't show up.
Well, that was my job. My job is security.
You've got to be the single point of failure.
My job is to not let us get into a single point of failure. I can't be it, right? Well, that's the worst possible.
Yeah, but then you put yourself out of a job.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I put a lot of people out of jobs. I've written a lot of scripts that have replaced important tasks that people were doing. I feel a little guilty about it. A little guilty,
It weren't that important if you just replaced them with a script.
We could do that and go yuck, 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 yuck until it's everybody's job. And then we're like, okay, our entire economic system is broken. Well, see, this is one of the reasons I think the currencies, coming back to Bitcoin, I think that the currencies are in trouble compared to Bitcoin because, our entire economic system is being undermined. There is a Yang. Have you heard about Yang, the presidential candidate?
No.
He's running on universal basic income. He's like number 4 or 5 on the list of the Democrats. He was one of Obama's advisors.
It doesn't work. Socialism does not work. Any country that's gone into has been destroyed.
I agree with you, but you know what? The reason that, we'll come back to that. I need to write this down, but I wanted
to... just lost half your viewers here.
Not necessarily. So, first of all, I didn't say it. So they might be waiting for me to hit you back. I did say I was a capitalist last time, but I'm a forgiving one. I understand people's motivations. I understand their thinking. I also understand where they're wrong, and I understand how that could be right. So, but I'll come back to that because I want to finish with the Bitcoin. I still haven't gotten to the point with the Bitcoin thing, which is that, there's tons of people out there doing Elliott wave analysis on Bitcoin, and they're just wrong. They're wrong a lot. And I noticed something.
Just because they do the analysis doesn't mean they know anything.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's true. So I realized something when I was looking at the descriptions of these things. So they're usually right when it's going up. Right, so when people are piling on and it's a panic to the top, that's when Elliott wave seems to really shine and seems to be correct. Especially if you do, because of course you could do it at any scale, right? You could do it at a minute-to-minute scale, or you could do it at a yearly scale. So at the week or the day or the hour or the minute kind of scale, while it's going up, it does seem to work. But it seems to break when it goes down. So I have a theory that Elliott wave itself. Now here's where we lose that one financial wonk. And he quits off the live stream because he's like, no, I can't listen to this anymore. It's sacrilege. So, sorry, preacher. Elliott wave joke. Where it's... it seems to me that Elliott wave came into being around the same time that the markets were really in a strong position to be manipulated. And what I mean by that is, Federal Reserve came into being in 1913, they start injecting money, everything's going gangbusters, and right around then is when the Elliott wave theory was starting to be developed. And then the book comes out in 1938 after the big crash. Now they've got control of, now it's not just the stocks that are going gangbusters because of the inflation, but now they can control the currency directly after the gold confiscation, right? So, yeah, sure, there are avenues for the currencies to go, but it's not everywhere anymore. It's not a completely open flowing market. Everyone isn't liquid in every position. And so that it's actually Elliott wave works best in a situation where the markets are at least to some degree manipulated, where there is a secret ledger present. So, and the reason, and it's not just willy-nilly, the reason why is because it works on the golden ratios, and the golden ratios are actually measuring, as a quick example, the way the golden ratios seem to work to me is it measures itself, and it comes up with, this is exactly how it works. A formula measures itself and says, okay, I'm this much smaller, and then just continues to do that, and that's what makes those Fibonacci
spirals that we're familiar with.
Right.
And so, you know, and that spiral perfectly describes, say, Africa, if you're talking about continents. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're looking at the continents on the surface of the planet. But it doesn't describe some of the other continents. Why? Because it's disruptive forces coming in and interrupting those marks coming in and measuring itself. So it's measuring itself. A fault line breaks as a major earthquake, and now the number that it's measuring is skewed and the shape changes.
Well, it's also based upon the person's perception. If I want it to go up, I'm going to discount factors when it's coming down.
Yes.
So if you use it in its pure form, you will see the ratios work in both ways. The problem is most people don't want to interpret it going down.
So this is like, of course, I'm completely abusing Heisenberg, but it totally applies. The Heisenberg principle doesn't just apply to quantum,
right,
quantum physics. It also applies to people.
Yep.
We react when our environment changes, mm-hmm, and just like, you know, just like people are constantly reinforcing these the golden lines. And you know, using them as resistance, either going up or down. At the same time, that's just because people have come to expect that, and that's the reason that's working is because the markets have all become much more tame and metered. So it's almost like everyone's like, because everyone screams their head off, what's the first thing people do when they lose a lot of money in the market? They attack the government. Just like whenever there's a physical a security attack, like in 9/11, everyone lost their mind and yelled at the government, you didn't do your job.
Right.
And now we have all these new terrible laws. You know, they overreact. And that overreaction is what people hate. Businesses hate that because they can't plan around it, right? Mm-hmm. You're planning to move this much, and then all of a sudden the market spikes out here because everyone has a fit,
right,
and you've lost a whole bunch of money. So people, you know, investors tend to want it to be very even-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think the Elliott wave doesn't always work on Bitcoin, and why the broader theory, the kind of the boom-bust, the simpler graphs, like the boom-bust, mm-hmm, head and shoulders, cup and handle, work better than just Elliott wave.
Well,
so now I think I got the whole thing out. Beat me up.
Well,
why is that not true?
You're also looking at different markets too.
Right.
So the Bitcoin is a global market versus a U.S. market.
Right.
So if you want to make, you know, if you look at markets in general, if you want to make money faster, you want to play all the markets as,
right,
opposed to one, because you can make money in the New York market, but when the New York market is in a slump, you know, the European market is doing well, or some other market is doing well.
Right.
So you want to move your stuff
for around now, because if the globalists,
right,
succeeded in making everything
then
flat,
then
wouldn't be the case anymore.
And then the other thing is that typically what happens with analysts is that if I'm an analyst and I'm using the Elliott wave theory and I'm saying, oh, you know, I'm on a roll here, every prediction I make is coming true, bet everything on that guy, but wait for him to make a bad one and then jump to someone else.
Right,
because his theories are only good in that particular market, and they don't handle the converses when.
Well, I think this is what's happening.
Down.
I think this is why we have cryptocurrency gurus on the way up.
Yeah, but they don't understand the whole market. They understand it.
Gurus on the way up.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, like, oh yeah, this works great, and then I'm on a private forum, and I just see people strike out month after month after month after month after month. They show their charts, you see the work, you're like, okay, this makes sense, I see what you're saying, and it's just wrong,
yeah,
over and over and over again. It doesn't, Elliott Wave doesn't work dependably on
Bitcoin.
Well,
the problem is that with the Elliott Wave is that when you get, you know, it's like you have this chart over here, and it's, you know, have this span.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can go down or I can go up at this point.
Right.
So they're making it saying, oh, we're going to go up, and it goes down.
Right.
Okay. Or if I'm over here, if this is a 1-2-3 wave, is the next one a 1-2-3 or is it a 4-5?
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I see a lot of that. I understand that,
yeah,
part. I'm not arguing against that.
A lot of it is what's the interpretation? Because when I'm at this point,
right,
I've identified that this is.
Is it resistance or is it a new floor?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I understand.
So is this the start of a one, or is this a continuation of the two and the three?
Right. Right.
For those who don't understand the 1-2-3.
Oh yeah, so it's right. So the Elliott wave has
Oh, by the way, none of this is in financial advice, and if you spend 1 cent on this, you're insane. Okay, so you know the way that Elliott Wave works is it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, the 4, 5 is optional. It doesn't.
Right. The 4, 5 is optional.
Doesn't always.
And then
happen.
It's A, B, C on the way down usually. Okay.
Yeah.
So and of course what they're looking for is they're looking for those golden ratios to decide where those points are going to be based on wherever it started and stopped, you know, what the absolute top and bottom were.
Yeah.
But of course, there's a lot of little rules that you can bring into this. And of course, whenever they hit one of those lines, they can go, oh, well, it's supposed to go down, or one of the guys says it goes up.
Yeah, and just as a point that everyone should know about, if you look at it in daily wave theory, figure you're going to spend a good year to 2 years studying it.
Right.
You're not going to do this in 5 minutes.
Right. I mean, I don't know that much about it.
Because you're going to spend a year studying basic charting, and then you can spend a year studying it.
But I've been doing like economics since the 90s, right. At least. You know, I mean, if it didn't have my attention before the dot-com crash, it definitely had it after.
Yeah.
So, I nailed the bottom on the housing crisis. That's when I bought my house. You know, I was successful with Bitcoin. You know, I've had a few successes, so I don't want to get too much into it. But
so what's your next prediction?
I've also had some failures too.
Well, we don't want to talk about that.
More Bitcoin. I think really that's where it is. At least. Yeah. For sure, there is no way there isn't a run to 100,000 in the card somewhere. I think the next run could be to like 44. That could be the possible, you know, top, and then be another year and a half before it went. But it could just,
This was like in the 70s and the 80s. It was like, it was a book, the Dow at 10,000. It's like, the Dow at 10,000, it's only at 1,100. Now the Dow's at like, what, 25, 30,000 or something?
Yeah. Well, that was an example of a bad trade. I don't want to make it like I'm like amazing. Yeah. I sold the Dow at 12 and thinking, okay, that's it, during the 2008 crisis, around the same time I bought my house. Sorry, it was 2011. So we're still in the we're still kind of lallying along from the 2008 crisis, and I'm like, yeah, this is gonna finally come out. And I think the reason I was wrong is I was wrong about the level of manipulation. There was just too much money injection.
Yeah.
You know, how many quantitative easings were there, which is really just money printing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, I was wrong. You know, buy the dip. The fucking dip, you idiot. You know.
I mean, it's been long overdue for a crash, and it's been just keep going up and up.
So. Yeah, I think we're not going to get it. This is a funny thing. So a lot of people are like, kind of like losing their marbles about Donald Trump, and here's the secret for me. So before Donald Trump was a president, he was one of my economic indicators. So whenever Donald Trump, it's funny, but no one ever listens to this. They get mad at me because as soon as they hear the word, they just boom, they spin off. So, but it's funny. He was my economic indicator. Whenever he showed up in the news, that means we were headed into a recession. Because I think he's like, oh, my most valuable asset is my brand, which, you know, from what we know about his books, is probably true. So as soon as he started, as soon as it looked like all of his investments were going to go south, and he's like, oh man, I need to refinance, I better become more popular,
well,
so that I can get better deals from the banks.
Yeah.
So then he shows up in the news, and I go, okay, we're headed for trouble. Here's trouble. So the interesting part about that is, now that he's president, there is no higher level of visibility unless the aliens come down and endorse them or something. So what does that mean? Why are people so calm? You know, on the one hand, they're like, oh, it's the end of the world. He's a monster. He's a terrible person. And you know, it doesn't. I'm kind of like framing this as like, it doesn't matter what you think about him, whether you're Republican or Democrat. It's a crisis or it isn't. He's really bad or it isn't. And maybe he is. You know, why are the wheels still on? You know, why are people still getting jobs? Why is the economy? Is it just that moment when the coyote runs off the cliff and it's, you know, like, you know?
I think we've been just down so long. It's the only place up. The only place to go is up.
Yeah. All right. So that's a bold prediction. I think you're right. I think that the reason why is because the only thing anyone could do is just try to print money. I mean, you know, velocity of money is terrible.
A better question is, look at all of the stuff that was going on in the 80s and
right.
90s. And then we had the crash, and then we had the 9/11 stuff going on in, you know, 2001, right?
Right.
Why is it, what's going on that there's not the same enthusiasm level about new products and stuff in development? I mean, there's just not, the same kind of enthusiasm level. And
So here's a question: is it because the business environment is so unstable?
I don't know.
And they can't make predictions, or is it because
there's a whole mindset gone to what are you doing for me today? And let me screw the employee, and let me I'm going to downsize everyone, and if you're working 20 hours last week...
Like there's no
I want
tomorrow.
You to work 40 hours this month, and then,
What does it matter what I do when there's no tomorrow?
Yeah,
it's kind of not a good situation.
Yeah, but now...
Why do they think it's no tomorrow? If we could fix that, the economy would go crazy, right?
Yeah, but, in the last few years, we've seen this whole change on employees, where it's like, instead of being a valuable employee, it's like, well, what did you do for me today? And, I want you to work 60 hours this a week this year, when last week you worked 40 hours. And if you don't want to do it, well, it was nice having you work here.
Right.
So what caused that whole mindset to change?
Well, I don't know. They don't really value them.
That's what's going on. I mean, look at what caused that mindset.
Right. That's just a lack of will to invest. Either that or just nobody's hiring anybody but psychopaths for those jobs.
I guess. I don't know.
I don't know. If you only care about your... if you think about it, the psychopath's perfectly set up to lead a company in that environment where it just matters what you do next quarter and everything else doesn't. Like, it's just what the next 90 days holds, and then after that,
it's all that short-term gain. What happens when you have a company or you have a machine and you say, gee, I'm going to step up production on that machine, run it on full blast, not put any oil in, and it works great for one quarter, right? And the following quarter, it's out of commission because it's broken.
Right, all the rivets popped off, the steam's flying everywhere.
So I'll give you the bonus because you did great production that month, but and you get a different job, and now the machine's broken, and the next guy's out of work.
So the real question is, are they just acting like psychopaths, or do they know something?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I was hoping to get an answer to that.
That's
one.
A whole.
That wasn't just a rhetorical.
That's
question.
A whole other conspiracy theory out there. If you want to go on that.
Yeah. Road. Okay.
I mean, let's look at it from a different point of view.
Yeah.
With all the hullabaloo that's going on, that they want you to focus on, mm-hmm. what's going on that they don't want you to focus on?
Right. Right. When someone's doing a song and dance, where are you not looking happening?
I mean, you can go, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about what's going on there, too.
Right. This is why I don't watch the news. I can't watch TV.
This is not the news, but...
Yeah. No. But, some of it is. Right? You see pieces of this, right?
Right.
You see a little pixel here and a pixel there of the bigger picture. I don't have an answer either. So, I don't know. What do you want to talk about? I've kind of led the conversation. No, I'm not out of ideas at all. If anything, I could drown you in them. But I want to know what you want. Is there something that you want to talk about? We talk about markets. We talk about meditation. We talked about. I know you mentioned a character. When we met before today,
a character
that you worked with. In the Wall Street days, but I don't know if you still want to talk about that or not. That was a really... I heard a piece of the story, and I actually stopped you because I wanted everyone to enjoy it like I'm enjoying it.
Which story was this?
About the guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I worked for an arbitre du jour that I put a system in for. Arbitre du jour is a person who does arbitrage.
Yeah.
Really cool name.
An arbitre du jour.
It's actually on my resume as being an arbitre du jour. So.
Very technocrat. Awesome. Keep going.
So, before I worked for him, he was a head trader at some undisclosed company in the city.
Yeah.
And he worked for like 2 or 3 years, never took a day off. So he finally...
Is this the guy that ended up losing the company? No, you didn't work for him.
No,
you
knew about him. He ended up killing himself somehow. I'm not sure how he killed himself. I think he just ran himself into the ground or something. But he was working every day. He was a head trader. Well, he was yelling at people and stuff like that. Knew how to apply pressure.
Right.
And so he takes a day off finally. So all the other traders hired a monkey. Put him in a suit.
A monkey?
He sat in his chair.
What?
And every time the monkey screamed, they said, "Yes, John, right away."
Did they videotape it or they?
No, this is before.
YouTube. Oh, so did he even know about it?
I think he found out about it. Yeah. You probably thought it was hysterical.
So they replaced him with a short script. I mean, monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of stuff we used to do when we were traders.
So, like, the Wolf of Wall Street, that's kind of, like, real, then.
That's absolutely real, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's bonkers.
That's a true story.
Where there's scantily clad women milling about.
It was also, I mean, we never had that kind of stuff, but, I mean, I could see how that could happen.
We never had that kind of stuff. Really? Really?
We were doing trading.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, because you guys were in the geek room. You were in the cool room.
We were actually making money as opposed to conning people. So.
Conning people is part of making money.
But like
not really. No.
The same trading group.
Yeah.
Had a the company used to do a company picnic. So one year they decide they're going to go out on a cruise.
Okay.
So all the traders dress up as swashbuckling pirates. They get another.
Oh, man.
They get the other boat.
I wish I had some pirate gear now.
They get the other boat, and they go and attack the boat with all the rest of the people on it, and they take the boat over.
Really?
Pirates, yeah.
That's spectacular.
And
oh,
they got
my God.
Pirate costumes and the whole bit.
That's really great. Did they talk in pirate accents when they did it?
I wasn't there. I don't know.
Would talk in a pirate accent. I would.
I was in a meeting the next day, and there were all these pirate costumes in the office. So.
Really?
Yeah.
So probably the wildest thing I ever saw in a corporate space was I was working my first real gig, like a big company. Mm-hmm. My manager was there, and he was married. He was a pretty normal guy, actually. I think they ended up firing him. They weren't too happy with his performance, partially because of me. I didn't try to get him fired, but I was like, yeah, you can't do this. So when he put me in a situation where I couldn't get to a client rather than rent a car because my car had died, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't rent me a car. And I'm like, these people are paying an ungodly amount of money for me to come and help them, and I'm not showing up when they're asking for me because you won't rent me a car for $60.
Yeah.
You know, I'll pay you back if it's really that important to you, but
well, you
I can't.
Got mileage anyway, so it's going to work.
My car is not working, so I need to get there. Yeah. Help me. And yeah, anyway. So it wasn't a bad guy. He just didn't understand the business. He was a construction guy. People were disposable. You know, they were interchangeable units. He didn't,
right.
You know, like, he didn't understand that. There's only 40,000 people in the world that can do this. There's only 50,000 people in the world that can do this. I was working on a DNS problem. And anyway, so we were at a party once, a corporate party, and we had they had all the stops. They had free drinks and food, you know, the usual swag at a techie or corporate party. And they had gambling tables, and they also had entertainment. And one of the entertainers was a Cher impersonator. The Cher impersonator was a transvestite, and I don't think he knew that because he was very happy when the Cher impersonator was sitting on his lap singing to him. And this is, and we know he's straight because he's got a wife, right? We've met her. They're like,
but
does he know that she's a tranny? You know, what's going on here? Well, of course, no one stopped it because it was a combination of political correctness and hilarity. So,
yeah.
Depending on the geek. So we just let it go. Yeah, that was some wild... when people get that, they get on this ego trip when they get that kind of money and that kind of power, and especially like...
Yeah, they lose all concept.
I mean, it's very easy to have... get yourself in a situation where millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars are flowing through your hands,
yeah.
And you feel like Captain Kirk. You're just like fire, you know. Like you have to know how to handle it. You have to know how to handle the power trip. So does it ever get you anymore? I imagine not, right? You're probably past
I don't
that.
Have that kind of money, so I'm not at that level. I don't have anything to worry about.
I don't want to out you, you know. All right, so sure you don't have that kind of money, right?
I wish I did.
Yeah. Yeah, it goes fast, right? When you get money in your hands and then you just burn through it and all right. So that was a good story. I didn't know about the pirate one. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So there's nothing else that you want to talk about because I'm going to start handing you
fire
up
away.
With all right. So
this is the magic cheat sheet.
This is the magic cheat sheet. All this is just some ideas I had for subjects to talk about. Do you watch any
TV shows or listen to any?
I watch.
Read any sci-fi or anything like that? You know.
Well, Rick and Morty, obviously.
Rick and Morty, really? Yeah. I didn't know you were a Rick and Morty fan.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then Mr. Robot.
Have you seen
one.
All of them?
Yeah.
Oh, great. So I can make.
Several times.
Ah, I had a pickled Rick prop. I could have brought it. I'm sorry if I had known. All right.
And then the Orville.
Okay. Oh, the Orville. Yes.
Yeah, it's on tonight, actually.
Yes. That's another one I remind.
I think it's just over right now. It's been another 7 minutes.
Oh, we're doomed. We're not going to be able to compete with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if anyone hasn't seen a show called American Gods, the new season is just starting. That's really good.
What's that about?
It's about it's basically mythology, but it's about the old gods and the new gods, and the old gods are Ian McShane, I think, is the lead character.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the old gods. He's supposed to be like who is he? He's one of like the Norse gods.
Okay.
And the new gods are like TV and the internet and that kind of stuff, and they're competing against each other for who's got more power.
Really?
Yeah.
And what's the name of this again?
American Gods. I think it's on AMC or one of those channels.
Stars, I think.
Stars, yeah.
All right, cool.
I think the new series either just started or is about to start.
Have you seen the new Star Trek at all, or you have to like get it?
Which one?
Rent.
I saw the first season.
CBS.
Of it, yeah.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah. I haven't seen it, so I know some Trekkies are pushing it on me, but they're Trekkies, so I'm like, I don't know if I could trust you guys that this is worthwhile.
Well, you know who plays the captain in that, right? He was the bad guy in Harry Potter.
Oh,
Malthus, the blonde guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see, I like him as
Malfoy.
An actor. Malfoy, yeah.
With the son, the young.
No,
one?
No, the father.
The father. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I like him as an actor. He's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
But he plays. I think he plays the captain.
Yeah, I forgot the name of the guy who played Snape, but I really miss him. He was also in Galaxy Quest too. Speaking of.
Oh Harry Potter.
Yeah, he was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a good actor.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I haven't gotten to watch it, but I was hoping you could sell me on whether is it worth it or is it
Which
worth
one?
Paying for the new Star Trek?
I didn't pay for it. I haven't seen it on
you
someone
sure
else's
you want
dime.
To be so illicit on
I
here?
I saw it on someone else's dime, let me put it that way.
Okay, fair enough.
That's as close as I can come to it.
Right, right. You happen to be walking through the room and then watch the entire series.
That's right.
Yeah, nice. How convenient. Yeah, I hope they don't bust him.
I'm a big Doctor Who fan from way back.
Right. So, you know, I don't think I've ever asked you about, like, I know you're running some Microsoft products. I don't think I've ever asked you about open source. I mean, are you...
Open source is a two-edged sword.
Right.
Because you go, I can get Linux for free. Okay,
right.
It's not free.
Right.
Because, you know, the
most
expensive...
Well, one level is just freeware, right?
The most expensive thing you're ever going to get is something you got for free.
Right.
So you need a certain amount of expertise with it and a certain amount of knowledge in order to get the thing working. I mean, you can get a machine up and use it, but I mean, if you're using it for a business, you're investing time into it,
right?
Versus buying a license. So there's a trade-off there,
right?
So yeah, open source is great, and I've actually converted over one of my laptops to Linux to see if I could survive without the Microsoft platform. It's working fine.
Okay. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. How many computers do you have at home?
Too many.
let me rephrase that. I have lots of computers here. How many computers are you running at home?
Running? I have one main machine I use, and I have a Linux box, which I really open up because I don't have time to use it.
Right.
And a couple laptops, which I don't really use.
Okay.
But most of the stuff I do, I just terminal serve into other machines. And
Right. Because you're totally in the cloud space.
Yeah.
You just spin up another VM. And
so, I mean, anything I do, I want to make sure I have remote access to the machine. That's one of the things that my pet peeve about Linux is getting the remote access. Finally, I found some remote access stuff that's pretty good.
Right.
Which I'm happy with. So I may do some more with that.
Okay.
But anything I got it. And I don't want just, you know, SSH shell.
If you change your brain about it a little bit, it's not too bad. So if you SSH in, if you get used to SSH again and adding in...
Yeah, I want the full desktop. I don't want SSH.
Right, right. Oh, no. But what I'm saying is, hear me out. So if you SSH in and you use the compression option so that, you know, you maximize that, you let the CPUs work a little harder on each side to make it fast. Mm-hmm. And if you use either the dash X or ideally the dash Y option, you can get a window up from the computer. So you don't get the whole Windows system, but you get the GUI for whatever it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. Assuming it's not 3D accelerated, which most aren't, you know, some are, it's really good. Mm-hmm. So if you just change your mind a little bit about how you're willing to work, that you're willing to have a window from a completely different operating system on here, and maybe you're going to, there are solutions for most programs on how to copy and paste and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, I used to work in in Unix, the real Unix.
All right. Yeah. So you know how X works.
So yeah. So we used to do a lot of stuff. I had like 6 Unix boxes around me at one time with lots of radiation coming out and things.
So I'm actually using. I'm still not happy. So eventually, I may do a talk on virtual machines and virtualization on Linux.
Yeah, the virtualization stuff today is phenomenal.
It really is. So I have two different machines running. One running Debian and one running the latest Fedora Core server. And I'm just doing some benchmarking between them. And it can be pretty fast, even over a gigabit network, running an entire graphical desktop as a VM on a dedicated server.
Right.
So that's another possibility, too, if you're looking to get in. You know, like if you don't want to, if you don't want to kill your electric bill, right, because it's kind of suicide in that sense. But, you know, how many machines you're willing to have running. But
yeah, every machine costs a lot. I mean, I have a couple of servers running in the house, and you know,
again, at the same time, if you have stuff up in the cloud and you're comfortable with that and you're already using that space, but remember, they're going to change the pricing model sooner or later. Amazon's going to leave growth mode, and everyone's going to be really shocked. I think it could crash the world economy when that happens.
I don't think that's going to happen because I think there's so much pressure from the other vendors and stuff. They've already dropped their price a couple times.
All right, I mean, they're going to drop their price, but I mean,
they make so much money. All their profit is from
chips. Aren't getting any faster.
All their profit is from the AWS, and a lot of their profit is from the RDS product, which is the relational database services that they offer.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. How do you know that?
Because I use it.
But that doesn't mean you understand their business model.
We look at the specs and stuff like that, but they get a tremendous amount of money from RDS itself. And what they've done with RDS is they took MySQL. Mm-hmm. And they broke it into two parts. So all the front end stuff is all regular MySQL, and the back end, which is they've optimized. So when they do replication, the back end does the replication differently than standard MySQL does it. Mm-hmm. MySQL says, okay, I'm right here, and then I'm going to copy it over here. What they do is you write in here, and then you go to a different data layer, and it writes to both of them at the same time. So it's much faster and it's much more flexible.
Okay,
and that
sounds pretty compelling. It sounds like something you're not going to want to set up on your own, especially if you're starting small.
Well, I mean, you can't set that up because it's their technology. They redid the open source for the back end.
Well, you can, but you're going to have to buy vendor products. You're going to have a presence across the world.
I mean,
you know.
they put a lot of money into it,
right?
And they're doing the same thing with.
So there's literally no competitor for RDS in your opinion.
Well, I mean, if I left the cloud right now, I could just go into regular MySQL. I could go to Oracle and use MySQL.
Right.
But it's not going to be as optimized.
Right.
For what they have the concept of when you set up...
Is it just pre-caching? Is that what they're doing? Or
no, they have the whole separate back end. The front end is over here, and then the whole back end is all optimized for doing caching. Well, not even caching. It's writing to the multiple instances.
Right.
So if I set up a... two machines. In an RDS instance, there's two machines. There's a primary. There's a read-write and a read-replica.
Mm-hmm.
So if I optimize my code, I can go to the read-replica and read, and only go to the write machine to do my writes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I have a lot of things going on, I can set up 10 read-replicas, and I can go really fast on those. And I just send my writes to the one, and it replicates out to all the rest of them.
Well, I totally understood. Well, I don't know if I totally understood. I mostly understood what you said. And it seems to me like that's something you could... I mean, it wouldn't be easy. It would be
You could redo it. I mean, Oracle hasn't redone it, and they own MySQL.
Right, right.
They haven't redone it in their product.
Yeah.
You know, but they did Aurora like that, which is the MySQL version, and they have Miranda DB. I think they're working on that.
Is it because they have a data center dedicated to this? Is that why they can do it better than everybody else?
Programmers who, you know,
because they can just you know, like use quality of service and just, you know, streamline, make the network connections for that RDS the highest priority. And,
I guess, yeah. I mean, have you looked at their product offering?
I've looked at RDS. Yeah, I got the basic idea.
If you go into AWS, you get presented with the screen of what you want. What do you want to do?
Right.
And they must have 60 or 70 product offerings in there. They got.
Right.
I mean, it takes you a couple days to figure out what these things do.
Right. Well, I mean, all right. So, like I totally like simplest case, right? A different kind of database.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at Route 53. Is that what they call their DNS?
No, that's the DNS. Yeah.
Yeah, the DNS. Right. So, you know, sure. you can put your DNS names in there and let them manage it, and it will be speedy fast.
Yeah,
and
great.
You'll be able to adjust it easily with the scripts, which, of course, they're going to put a lot of love into their scripts to adjust it. But, you know, without your DNS name, whatever product you, all your branding, all your marketing is just gone.
Oh, I don't need their DNS server to run.
Well, no, I know. But, I mean, this is what I'm trying to say about, you know, like, yeah, if you're wholly dependent on them, you know.
Well, it's just a DNS server. I mean, I can move that tomorrow to GoDaddy or to any other DNS provider.
I mean, you know,
provider.
Yeah, it never goes as smooth as promised, but yes.
I've moved them several times. It goes pretty, I mean.
Right. I mean, you shrink your TTLs on that to almost nothing.
It takes a day, and then it's back up and running, you know.
Right. Well, I guess that's it, right? So I'm thinking in two or three or four nines uptime, and really nobody works like that anymore.
I mean, even they'll tell you they don't have, you know, if you do a failover, so you're gonna be down for a couple of minutes before the failover takes place.
Right.
Because you can do a failover when you can set up your instances so that in the certain cases it spawns up another instance automatically and then load balances and stuff, but that still takes time. It still takes a minute or whatever to spawn it off.
Right.
So, I mean, even they'll tell you, you know, the sales guys will tell you, you know, you're going to be down for 30 seconds or a minute or whatever the replication time is.
Steve, can I bug you for a water or something? I'm like, I'm parched. I can't, you're actually talking me out. I don't think that was, I didn't think that was possible.
Sure.
Great, thanks a lot. Yeah, so, okay, well, that's pretty interesting. Do you have anything, I know you mentioned a couple of kind of woo-woo kind of out there things.
Which ones?
You know, I'm going to leave it up to you to bring them up because I don't want to introduce new topics.
Okay, you can introduce them.
We were talking a little bit about aliens.
Okay, so...
You said you had some unique theories on aliens and alien life. Which is actually bizarre as it sounds.
Let's throw aside whether you believe in aliens or not, okay?
Right.
Let's just look at some of the facts.
Right.
The facts are that since you know, for the last 20 years, there's been a bunch of encounters that people have had, and they've walked away with a couple of takeaways. One takeaway is that these are not necessarily aliens, but they're time-traveling beings from the future coming back to get DNA to repair crap that's been broken.
Right.
And what's been broken here? All the crap that we're doing with inoculations and such, and all the GMOs that are going on are just destroying our DNA.
Okay,
whether you believe in aliens or not, let's look at the message that came out.
And the loose radiation, you know, whether it's particles or just radiation from secondary radiation.
Right.
From the sources that are irradiating, you know, damaging the DNA of other things.
Yeah, if you look at the history books, there's a history book in Japan.
Oh, here we go. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This is our technician guy here, Steve. Oh, he missed it. He didn't get on. Give him a hand.
Thank you. That feels so good.
If you look at...
like I'm in the desert.
If you look at Japan, there's actually some history maps where they show mushroom clouds all over the planet.
Right.
This was from one of the nuclear wars from years ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, the nuclear war has been going on here forever.
What? Mushroom clouds...
On the map, dated, you know, I don't know what the dates of the map were, but they show mushroom clouds.
What map is this?
This is some map I saw from some Japan, some ancient Japan text.
Or it's a historical...
It's an actual text, yeah.
Yeah, and do they... is it, like, carbon dated? How do you know old?
I don't know. I don't remember what the period was. But if you look back, there's been, in the last, let's say, 30,000 years... There's been several civilizations that have supposedly existed, okay?
Right.
And they basically the Lemurian civilization and the Atlantis civilization were at war with each other.
Okay.
And they.
So you think Atlantis was real? And
yeah, it was real.
I think so.
If you do age regressions and stuff, you can get people from Atlantis.
I just can't believe Plato was lying about that. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, because of the other work that we did. But
right.
We'll talk about that next.
Right. This ain't on the sheet, people, but that's actually the best part. So,
okay, so that the theory is that the Atlanteans had satellite technology where they're able to disrupt the planet.
Oh, so
and
you
send
think
stuff
this
down
is
and cause earthquakes and different things.
So you think this is civilization's first go around that we would?
This is like the third go around.
Ah, okay, interesting.
It's the third set of 30,000 years.
So I know that there was a shock of in the official scientific community. They found some arch that was 13,000 years old, and that, of course...
Well, I mean...
it was like, well, this shouldn't exist, because we supposedly started it 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, well, I'll give you something even better than that.
Mm-hmm.
The in, I don't know, eight or 10 years ago, we went through something called the photon belt,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people in know were very concerned about, because it was supposed to wipe out... the whole electrical system
mm-hmm.
went through the photon belt.
I remember that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember
now,
this.
We happened to get through that okay, and there is a subculture, we call it the cabal, the dark forces, whatever you want to call it, that have all these underground cities that they were preparing for in case we went through there, they would be protected. So while they're creating these cities...
Well, if you're a billionaire, you build a panic room. It's just what you do.
This is way beyond billionaires, but...
Yeah.
But they built these machines that basically can go through, carve through rock and be able to melt the rock. They're all nuclear powered. They were able to melt the rock and create, like, tunnels and things. And what they found is first of all, let me preface that. When you're done with the machine, you just kind of leave it where it is and you throw it away because it costs too much to take it out.
Right, fair enough.
So they actually, according to the reports, they found previous machines like this.
The oh,
same
really?
Kind of machine from previous civilization.
And what was the dig location? Do you know or no one knows?
Well, there's different theories about it. There's about 30 of these cities in the United States.
Okay.
I've seen the map.
Well, I mean, I know that there's vast underground, vast underground bases in Colorado for sure. I know that.
Yeah,
that's
but there's
where,
also,
that's
there's
where the backup government is.
There's an underground tunnel system where, like, you can drive your tractor trailer from the south all the way up to Massachusetts.
Right.
I mean, it's phenomenal stuff. That's stuff they have that people don't really believe exists.
And there was a conspiracy theory about that time that there was a quake in D.C. that was actually an underground explosion.
Well, it was thought to be a disruption from space aliens to knock out one of the bases of the dark
really?
Forces
so,
that
so,
were down there.
So that, space that, aliens aren't just theoretical for you. You think that
well, at last count, there were 52 different species monitoring the planet.
What? you guys are so boring compared to that. 52 species?
53. I think it was 52.
So is that like the entirety of the local alien population, you think? I mean, that would
make
sense.
Different species, not different people. Right.
Oh, no, 50, I understand.
Yeah.
50,
it was about like three or four.
Like the Federation,
right,
for example.
It was like three or four that were considered the negative entities.
Like if you look at it through the lens of Star Trek, for sci-fi, there's maybe 52 species on that program.
Yeah. And
right?
This
and
this
that would
all,
be just all the local solar systems that have intelligent life are all on a team.
Yeah.
Just in case the Klingons show up, we want to be all together.
Well, this is all stuff on the internet if you want to look this stuff up.
Uh-huh.
But there's the... what is it called? It's the Federation of Planets, is it? I don't know. It's one of those things where there's a group monitoring this planet because we're under basically a it's a restricted planet.
Right.
So you can't just come in and do stuff because we're an evolving species.
Well, it makes sense because we're idiots.
Well, it's a quarantine
planet. In the nicest way. We haven't figured it all out yet.
It's the theory there's no intelligent life in the universe, so they may fit that model.
Right. So, I have a Civ gene thing about that. So.
So we're a planet that's under quarantine, and we're evolving into the next level right now.
Right.
That was a whole 2012.
That
was a whole 2012 thing with December 21st, 2012, was a pinnacle point. Now we're moving into another period. There's a lot more stuff we can get into.
Age of Aquarius. Yes.
Yeah, it's beyond the scope of the conversation here, but
right. No, don't be afraid. It's fine. I'm interested in this. I'm more spooky than I let on. I don't normally start conversations about this kind of stuff because some people are off put by it or they're nervous about it. But I think it's super interesting. And while I'm not willing to commit to it without it being in my hands, at the same time. I think conspiracy theories are good for people.
I mean, go read a book.
So I think it's I think it's actually healthy for people to theorize about what's going on. Like Hawking, right before he died, was like, "Yeah, don't assume aliens are going to be friendly." You know, is a perfect example.
Well, of he's
the human mindset being just, you know, funneled into a point of stupidity, and it's like, yeah, probably.
Well, there are benevolent societies and there are non-benevolent societies. So,
right,
you know,
right.
There's, you know, everyone says, well, why would they come here and help you? Well, that's part of the universe, you know, and there are ones that don't want to help us.
Well, they may not want to help us. It might be that the technologies get so wildly out of control if they don't guide us, we'll end up killing everyone, including them.
So
it might be self-interest.
Comes back to my point of
if a warp field was sufficiently large, it could create a black hole, right? You know,
without spiritual growth, the technical growth becomes very dangerous.
Right.
You know, what we have here is technical growth without spiritual growth, with all these crazy leaders.
Yes, and that's clearly happening. You know, regardless of, you know, without a yardstick to compare it to, that is happening.
Right.
You know, we definitely have. I mean, that's the essence of the technocracy. You know, that we have these technologies that are spinning wildly out of control, and nobody's, you know. Especially people are, like we were saying before, let's say people are building the brick wall and they're learning technologies and they're learning on the job, you know, you don't have to have any college at all to get into the tech field. I mean, it helps. It can make you a better programmer. It can make you a better technician.
If you're a good learner, you can do it.
You can just do it on your own.
And
one of the things you have in colleges are ethics classes. You know, if you never take that ethics class, do you ever ask the hard questions?
Well,
sure. If you're passionately curious, you might. But some people might not.
Well, we never took ethics classes. That's something new they added after me.
Or civics, or you know, psychology, or you know, anything where you're thinking about how other people are impacted by you know, your actions and
right.
You know, so, yeah, I mean, of course, it would make sense that aliens would have, a first contact kind of moment, right, this is what you have to do
to get
to this point.
So let's move into the conspiracy theory.
All right, sure.
One of the things that's going on right now is all this focus on all this hullabaloo that's going on in the government, right?
Right.
And one of the theories is that it's going on because they're trying to subvert the disclosure of the fact that there's aliens and stuff out there. I mean, Russia came out and reported about it. Argentina, I think, came out, one of the other countries, and there was two or three other countries that came in and said, yeah, we have contact with aliens, but didn't make the news because it wasn't the United States that did it. The countries are pushing the United States to do disclosure, and they don't want to do it.
Why do you think that is?
Because the United States is controlled.
Because we're in charge right now.
We're controlled.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's a group that's controlling it, and they're slowly losing
power.
What's
so important about this country? Well, I mean, I'm, all right, right.
What that's, leaders? What
in
leaders
a, well, right well one, one level, that's a dumb question, right? We're a quarter of the world's GDP.
Right.
You know, if we sneeze, the world gets a cold. You know, but at the same level, you know, what's so important about the United States? What is it? Is it that our government is better, or just that it interferes with other people's governments the way it's structured? Or
the foundation of the United States was unique.
When, you know, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
The whole "We the People" thing is a unique document.
Right.
And it's unique to the.
I think I need some wine.
It's somewhat
keep
unique.
Going.
It's somewhat unique in the universe too.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Yeah, so you're thinking that there's something inherent to the United States and the way that it's structured.
I don't know what it is, but yeah, there's something. They're looking for the United States to take the lead on it. If we say it's going to be true, if some other country says it, it's not necessarily going to be true.
Got a pair of pliers. I'm just breaking on the table. Thanks a lot, man. Yeah, all right, look, you know, I have all this stuff. I'm so prepared, and I don't have a corkscrew.
I have one in my other bag. I don't have it with me here.
Yeah, I know. I usually have a Swiss Army knife with a corkscrew on it.
But I just
don't have it today.
One of the Sommelier corkscrews. So now getting back to let's go on a little tangent. I did a year-long study on age regression, on past life regression. So if you want to age regress someone, and I haven't done it, but I know there's been a lot of other people who have regressed people back to Atlantean times.
Right.
And they've gotten information from that. So, I mean, the information is out.
I am convinced, all right, regardless of whether it was from another age, I don't think it was from another age, but I am convinced that my younger son he's lived a life before.
What,
I mean, it's kind of self-contradictory.
When was he born?
He's eight, so he was born.
So he's one of the new people coming in.
Yeah, but I swear he's living. He was
absolutely.
Born.
Ask him where
he was born with a high and tight. He had like a Austrian, German, Russian accent, like that part of the world.
He's one of the.
It's the strangest thing. He's a kid. What is he getting this stuff? You know, the stuff. You know, he was like, he was born with ripped with muscles. He had a very military kind of mentality. We're not like that. Our family's not like that. You know, it's just all him.
It's the new. Generation coming in, they're the new seeds of moving forward with the evolution of the planet.
Yeah,
and they have certain abilities which they may be hiding.
Right.
You know, a lot of them have all sorts of things. He may remember his past lives, or just want to talk about it.
Right. I mean, if you
ask him about it, he may tell
you. It's not just him. I mean, I was actually, I went on a school trip with him
to the zoo, and his friends
and him were joking about how he has a different accent.
Yeah.
Actually, my other son has a British accent. We know where that came from. That was from Thomas the Train and watching Ringo Starr narrated Thomas the Train with his thick British accent, you know, so he picked that up from him.
Yeah.
But this one, he had no influence. Like, where did it come? It sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, and he's big too, so it just fits the whole mantra,
right?
You know, it doesn't. Where
well, ask him who he was.
I will before he gets too old, right?
About 13, they start to lose it,
right?
Because when they start to go into puberty, they start to focus more in beta than in alpha,
right?
And they start
right.
to lose all those memories.
Interesting. So, thanks a lot. I'm sorry about that.
I think you drank half of it though.
Everybody drinks all around.
Area 22 tax.
Thanks so much. You want some?
No, thanks.
Okay.
I'm driving.
I figured one's okay. So, so of course, you're familiar with type 1, type 2, type 3 civilization. So type 1 civilizations where the planet's more or less acting as a whole.
Right.
So I think...
Is that a Star Trek or what?
Well, it wasn't. It was a different sci-fi writer, but it's kind of accepted lingo now for what it means when humanity kind of gets past countries.
Right. A lot of the sci-fi writers are all
And a lot of... You know, one of the things that annoys me about the globalists, I totally... On the one hand, I understand the desperate and excitedness for, yes, we're going to be one planet, but you can't force it. You know, you can't force everyone into a bunch of taxes to force everyone into a global government.
One planet means everyone's going to be more benevolent.
Right.
They're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to tax you and you're going to be subservient to me and you're going to be the producers and we're going to be the upper echelon. I mean, that's not the natural flow of the universe here.
Yeah, I don't think so either. There's, you know, the concept in that Star Trek movie in First Contact was the warp field was the Type 1 civilization
right.
moment where other aliens said, okay, these guys are ready.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think that moment is? What do you think what's the task that we have to do?
The task is that you need to be a more enlightened individual. And right now, there's what I call graduating. So you need to be at the point where spiritually you can graduate and move on to the next dimension, so to speak.
Right.
And there's about last time I checked, it was about 20-25% of the population has reached that point.
Right.
Okay, and then there needs to be a critical mass of a little over 10% in order to accomplish that. Now, if the 20% got together and said, we want world peace, we'd have world peace tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a thing called the Maharishi effect.
Right, I'm familiar with it.
Where they did...
Well, why don't you explain it for the...
Okay, the Maharishi effect, they took about a study of, I don't know, 10,000 people or so in like a big dome, and they all, you know, meditated on world peace, and they saw a reduction in peace for the next few months, a reduction in violence for the next few months. They saw more world peace.
Really?
So on a side note,
there was something. There was somebody made an observation. It was in the 50s or the 60s with monkeys.
The 100th monkey.
The 100th monkey, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
But once the 100th monkey learned something, for some reason, all the other monkeys suddenly knew it.
Yeah, you reached critical mass with the thing.
I've left the realm of credibility as far as having deeply researched this stuff and verified it's true, but I assume it is.
There's a couple books written on it.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
I don't know what that
is. Yeah, there's a famous book called The 100th Monkey.
So, like, you know, I have this theory, the Siv Gene theory, and that psychopaths preceded other human beings on the planet. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter when. It doesn't matter if we've had three major civilizations or one. But before the first civilization, at that point, that's when the first non-psychopath was born, and that we're behaviorally different than the rest of the planet. So, and it would be kind of interesting. I think maybe one of the reasons that it hasn't taken off is, here's a good conspiracy theory about myself, a possible reason that it hasn't taken off is, let's say I'm right, and there is a, and the gene that defines... people who are not psychopaths and separates them from people who are psychopaths is findable, and we find it. We use the techniques I described on my site to find it. We could get into a situation where they say, okay, let's exhume some graves and look at some DNA from people, and they find that, okay, why was the civilization gene appearing 35,000 years ago and not 10,000 years ago?
Right.
It'll screw the narrative up. So that is a possible fitting with your conspiracy theory. I created one for myself to explain one reason why civilization gene isn't more popular. Mm-hmm. You know, people are in complete denial about the nature of psychopaths. So I actually think the type 1 civilization point is where we recognize that, anywhere from 1/30th to 1/20th of the population acts completely differently than us. They're just animalistic, completely selfish, highly logical. I think this emphasis on logic is just bonkers. That our society's really gone. I mean, logic is great. I'm not against it. It's not a panacea, because the logical thing to do sometimes is kill someone. You know, like if I can get away with it. I mean, you have government right in the way, and there's cameras everywhere. But I mean, like, it's terrible to say it that way. But when you say it that way, you realize, oh, okay, I'm just nice because I'm nice. I'm not nice because I'm afraid of the government and I've done a long calculation in my head.
Yeah.
You know, and that's there's lots of studies to back that up. There was a lot of work done on this in the 60s. There's some economics, economics and psychology kind of blend together in that space. Anyway, so I think one of the things is when people really recognize that if I'm right, civilization gene is correct, I think civilization gene could be wide acceptance of it and incorporation of it into global society actually could possibly be a type 1 civilization marker. Maybe not the only one. Maybe we have to do that and a warp field. I don't know what's going to make them say,
hi. It's all personal growth. It's not the creating technology. Oh,
but it sounds like what you're saying is, well, right. But we're like, again, when we hit a percentage of people who are really understand that, you know, not everyone's nice, you know, and actually recognizing that allows you to be nice to the people that aren't nice. Yeah. And you can be kinder by being more realistic about how the world is.
So getting back to the Maharishi effect, one of the projects that we have on our plate is to create a group that does an experiment on levitation. So the theory is that...
Telekinesis?
Yeah.
Let me
finish this. One of the theories is the way the pyramids were built was levitated in. And there's different theories about even that. They did it with sound or they did it with mental abilities. So one of the things we'd like to do is get like 10,000 people in an auditorium. I'd prefer Red Rock out in Colorado, but that's just a personal preference.
Okay.
Get like 10,000 people in an auditorium.
Does it have to be an indoor space or can it be outdoor?
Well, the Red Rock's outside.
I
don't know if you've been there.
I haven't been there.
And get like 10,000 people in there. Everyone meditates on bringing this 5-ton boulder in, and we all meditate on lifting it up to see what happens.
So here's the interesting question. What if it succeeds?
I think it would, personally.
Really?
Yeah.
So here's another question. Why hasn't that happened already?
We don't know that it hasn't.
Oh. So what you're saying is you should set up a good dead man switch so that before you leave, so that if you go on this and don't return, that says we were probably successful in moving the rock, this is what happened to us. Maybe you just did that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, there you go.
But, I mean, you're starting to see some levitation stuff with the new kids coming in now.
Really?
Ask your son if he can do it.
I mean, you know, the problem is, so I haven't seen it personally, firsthand, and the problem is, you know, I can't trust video, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have this show live, is because it's like, it's so hard to edit video real time. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see this and say, okay, if someone can verify, yes, I saw that live and that's what happened and it hasn't changed.
Well, even if you do this live, people are going to go, oh, it was a magic trick.
Well, something like that, yeah.
You know, what was the guy, David Copperfield, made the Statue of Liberty disappear?
But don't let that discourage you if you want to levitate something in here.
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not me, please. Anything else?
I don't think we'll be doing that tonight.
No, okay. Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because I know how I am, and I sound very sarcastic, and I'm like, it sounds almost like I'm like mocking you, but I'm not. I'm actually, I just have to be careful because I have my own set of like down-earth scientific theories that I think are provable, and I want to make sure that people don't think that I think something that...
it's magic today, it's science tomorrow, right?
Right. That I haven't mistaken where the periphery is. So science is... Science doesn't refute the supernatural, it just ignores it. It just goes, I don't care about it.
It just tries to explain it.
Well, it tries to explain it, right? But it ignores it until it can explain it. And a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that science refutes the supernatural. Like, if someone claims something supernatural has happened, then it can't possibly be science. No, it just means that you're working in the space where new science is
going
to be done.
You may not understand what's going on.
Right, you just don't get what's going on yet. It's just an undeveloped technology, like you put it, like
the
Highline quote.
There's lots of stuff in our reality that we ignore because we don't understand it.
Right. I like to go to the fear, so I refuse to let that stuff scare me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also recognize that, you know, without predictability or repeatability, those are the two, that's what real science is. You know, like either I can do this over and over and over again, and I can tell other people and give people specific instructions and they can repeat it. You know, the most obvious case is Newtonian physics, right? Nobody denies Newtonian physics. The parabola is used in every video game that everybody ever plays with any kind of realism.
Right.
You know, you throw an object in the air and how it returns to the earth. The numbers are always the same. If all things are equal, the numbers are always the same. And so that's the testing ability. But in the absence of testing, mm-hmm. right, you have the ethics. You can't really experiment on people, right? I mean, you could, but you would be not very nice. And
how do you know you're not being experimented on? I mean,
I know everyone's not nice. As a hard fact, psychopaths are real; they're not made up. So I know.
Mean, just look at the. What was the name of the project?
I mean, I've been, you know, I've had bosses at jobs. Why wouldn't they? Weren't they experimenting on me?
Yeah.
You know?
What was the name of that project? The begins with an M. It slips my mind right now. I'll think of it later.
I try to use the guide of I do think people are out to get me, but I don't know if they're working together. You know, they might be. The question is, do they have the resources to work together?
Who?
Whoever. You know, if people are experimenting on me, right? You know,
you're not being experimented on. You'd have certain characteristics if you were.
Right. So, how do you feel about that? You said you had that company with the predictability, right, where you guys almost did like the bug bounty,
right?
Yeah, in the .com days. Have you thought about starting up something like that for like bug bounties for certain milestones in telekinesis or telepathy or?
No, not specifically.
Right.
But I mean, we want to focus on the levitation rock thing.
The levitation rock thing.
The next couple of years.
Right. Do you think that would work if somebody did that? Or?
I think it would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
sooner or later, someone will produce a rock floating in the air.
I mean, I've seen other things move by mental.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yeah.
So, I just met with a bunch of people this summer, and they had attended some kind of spoon bending seminar.
Oh, yeah, we used to do that with the kids in one of my classes.
Really?
Yeah. That was all the Uri Geller stuff.
Wow.
So, you do, you know.
How does that work? I never understood that, so.
You focus on it, and you rub your spoon, all of a sudden it bends. You know, I mean, some people have more of an ability to do it. I've never been able to do it, but other people have more of an ability.
So is there like a thermodynamics explanation for it, that the rubbing creates heat in a certain spot?
No, it's you're energizing the metal, because if you manipulatively analyze the metal hasn't bent. Whereas if I take a spoon and bend it, I can see the stress marks.
Right, right.
But if I do,
I work with metal.
If I do it with mental abilities, there's no stress mark. In
like
metal.
Aluminum is very weak to that, and it becomes structurally different. You can't use it after you bend it.
There's no stress mark in the metal. Yeah, when you do that.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So
in case you're wondering what we're talking about, so
we're going off the edge.
We might be a little over the edge. So I build stuff, and so one of the things with aluminum, of course, is light and really strong, and it's great that way, but you can't really bend aluminum. It doesn't really bend much. It gives
it
a little bit.
It doesn't like to be bent.
It doesn't like to be bent. When you put it under stress, it just starts coming up with cracks.
Yeah.
And so you have to forge it into the shape that you want. You can trim pieces off of it and cut into it, but if you start putting a shear kind of stress on it,
It just cracks.
It just cracks. So, but of course, the alignment, the molecular alignment of any metal will change. It's just that it's not so disadvantageous in steel, but there's still a clear change in the molecular alignment if it's been bent.
Well, it's like,
you know, it does get weaker, but it's not
it's
nearly
like
as weak.
If you look at any of the stuff from crop circles, the real crop circles, mm-hmm. when the plants have been bent, they're not. There's no stress marks in them. It's just somehow naturally they bend like that.
It's been laid over.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like something someone could do on the ground.
Well, you could, but I mean, when these things appear within seconds, it's kind of, you know. But
right.
there's fake ones and then there's real ones.
Well, of course, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if a bunch of drunk farmers, you know. Cow tip in a crop circles, you know.
I doubt they
what are we doing tonight, guys?
First of all, the crop circle phenomenon has got back thousands of, well, probably it's recorded going back to the Middle Ages.
Right.
And in fact, there was a decree by some of the priests where you weren't allowed to go into the crop circles.
Right.
So when the crop circles appeared. So, you know, there were people back then making crop circles? I kind of doubt it.
Right. So I am... Yeah, okay. That's fair enough. I see what you're saying. Well, you couldn't really take a satellite photo, so it wouldn't have the same impact. So actually, you might be making the same...
What of the satellite?
Or like an aerial photo. You couldn't...
Of what? The crop circle?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you never seen them?
No, I've seen them. I know what you're talking about. I've actually seen... I know someone who's written software to try to analyze them.
Yeah, there's
so,
thousands of them.
Well,
and they,
no.
And they follow a pattern. There's actually messages coming through in the crop circles.
Right.
So if you follow there's patterns that are coming through on, you know, the different crop circles.
Right. Well, it's just that we're in the symbolic analysis business, so it's just another set of symbols to analyze.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, and inherently, when you're dealing with a society where people are different stratifications, either of intelligence or possibly different emotional stratifications, like empaths versus psychopaths. I'm using empaths in a way that other people don't, but it's just so I'm so tired of saying not a psychopath, so it's just empaths. It's easier, you know. Whatever your stratification model is, I've forgotten what I was going to say. I was whatever your stratification model is. Whatever.
Are you all talked out here at this point?
No, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. This is kind of cool, though. I don't want to stop. It doesn't really matter how you're looking at it. Yeah, it's not coming back to me. All right. Well, we'll move on and go on to the next thing. What got you in interested in crop circles in the first place? Is it just that...
It's just a part of the whole genre.
Is it just that you saw a picture of a crop circle and said there's something to this? Or
I don't have that much of a fascination with crop circles. I'm just aware of what they are. They're in kind of the genre of...
The officially denied genre where the government said that says that's not real.
I was supposed to be in something called the Pythagoras Conference.
Right.
By Sandra Sabatini was running it. You do a search for it. I think she's got a show on. I forget what the show is called. You can look it up. And this was supposed to take place in Louisville, Kentucky, a couple years ago, mm-hmm. and we were all set to go. I was going to do a talk on age regression. And I was going to do a talk on the Akashic Records.
Okay, Akashic Records.
It was a whole other thing. We'll go into that another time.
Okay, yeah.
And
I still have tons of questions for you.
I'm set to go down there on. I was going to leave like Saturday night or Friday night. Saturday night or Sunday night. I think it was going to leave Sunday. The conference started like on Wednesday. I was going to get there like Tuesday, and we were going to set up and get appropriate. Adjusted to it and everything. I get a call from Sandra on Saturday night that the venue that we were having it is decided that they didn't want us there at the last minute.
Really?
Now, we were going to have, there was all sorts of people talking about time travel, about elongated skeleton heads in South America, and all sorts of fringe science.
Right, right.
And it was.
I've heard the conspiracy theories about the Smithsonian. So,
yeah,
basically being just a honeypot to just suck everything up and lock it away like the Ark of the Covenant.
But yeah, there was like 20 or 30 of us going to talk there. It was all in fringe science.
Right.
And at the last minute, they nixed it for some reason.
Right.
Who knows who nixed it? But a lot of people were pissed at Sandra for that. But I don't think it was out of her control.
Right. Well, sometimes it's just having run a group for years, and sometimes it's just.
you know, something material happens.
No, it was something else.
It was something else.
Okay. It was a conspiracy theory type thing.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that happened, but hopefully it'll work out for next time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I remember what I was going to say because it was a good point, but I just had to make so many segues. There was a stick from the last one. So many segues that I just lost track of my thought on it. All right. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to wrap up with? Something you want to plug your business or talk about it last?
I'm going to be at. Let's see. I have this written down here.
I don't think I'm done, but you know, just in case.
I'm going to be at Opal's annual cybersecurity summit, taking place July 10th to July 12th, 2019, in Newport, Rhode Island, at Gurney's, and I'll be on the phishing, hacking, hackers, and threats panel. If anyone is interested.
Really, oh, I love panels. They're so fun. Yeah. If I ever did a panel here, would you be interested in coming back?
And absolutely.
Okay, great. There's some talk about possibly getting together different panels for. I want to have people on individually because I want to hear what they think.
And
think about what I said for next time, and let me know if you can figure out what you think the our Type 1 civilization moment is, because it doesn't really matter. You know, like when is the point where? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that aliens are contacting people from different countries, and that.
They're here right now. They're educating.
They're just not playing ball with our country.
Just look at In Search of Ancient Astronauts or one of those shows.
Right.
Where they had a whole series on how a lot of people who were like Teslas and those kind of things, mm-hmm. those kind of people have been, you know, they're getting information from somewhere.
Do you think it's just disclosure penetration? Is that just what we're waiting for?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big key points right now.
All right.
Well, to give you an example, we were in tight with a guy who used to run the Project Blue Book, Colonel Wendell Stevens. We spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. And he told us at this was a number of years ago, he said, and one of the things that the aliens are looking for mm-hmm. is they have what they call an event clock. They don't look at time the way we do.
That's what I'm talking about. They look at events.
One of the events.
I now have those two words together, event clock. So, talking about what the event clock is.
So
like.
One of the things that they were looking on the event clock was for the Ayatollah Khomeini to be thrown into the streets. Okay. He told us this 2 weeks before Khomeini died, mm-hmm. and when Khomeini died, they were carrying his coffin down the street, and his followers ran up to him and he got thrown into the street.
Really?
That was like 2 weeks before.
A week before
that whole thing happened.
Well, so all right. In fairness, the counter, I'm playing devil's advocate here. The devil's advocate position is he's a general. Of course, he knew he had rumblings about the intelligence of other countries and how far things were going. It's like there were definitely people were fleeing that country before that happened. They saw it coming. You know.
Well, he told us a bunch of other things on the event clock that haven't happened yet. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And I assume that's proprietary and he's not going to.
One of them was a limited nuclear exchange in the Middle East. That was a big event.
But really? What's that a temple marker for?
Just as a progression of things to happen. And now, nothing is cast in stone. It doesn't have to happen.
No, I understand.
You know, if we evolve more, then it won't happen.
Look
what happened over the last couple of days. It was all sorts of raucous firing from one into Israel, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it happened yesterday or today, I think.
So I'm gonna give myself a universal disclaimer here, and then I'm gonna go into something my own kind of woo-woo thing. So my universal disclaimer is that I have my own theories about how predictive technology works. So I think, you know, what we think of as psychic is actually the subconscious doing kind of a distributed computer kind of back. Because there's definitely some really compelling future telling out there.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's wrong,
there's lots of fakers, obviously, but there's also some really, like, people make predictions and there's like, okay, there's no tangible reason why that prediction was right, and yet it is. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? So I think the way that
look at the predictions of the Simpsons.
Oh yeah. Well, I think artists are some of the best at expressing those.
There's a whole other conspiracy theory about that one, but that's another topic.
So I think there's actually a rational, kind of down to earth explanation for this, and it doesn't discount anything else at the edge of the periphery. It's just that I'm kind of pushing the edge of the periphery a little further out and saying, okay, psychic projections, there's a reason for it, and it isn't actually psychic. I think what's going on is that we're basically acting like a SETI at home kind of computer. Human beings are, mm-hmm. and then we actually use linguistic shifts to communicate with each other, and that subconsciously, and that we're kind of giving each other jobs to work on subconsciously, and our conscience and our subconscious are the same thing, mm-hmm. like, you know, the same thing that you were visiting when we're in a gamma state or in a beta state, and
theta.
Theta? Gamma and beta or coma. Sorry.
Right.
Theta. Right. So when I'm jogging and I feel the runner's high and I get to go into the ether.
You've entered flow at that point.
Right. They entered the flow. Yeah. So that kind of the things that you can see when you're in the flow state, they're always there, but they're...
Right. But you're open to it.
Right. Your rational mind can communicate with your subconscious.
Right. Well, what happens is the part of your mind that focuses on time flow, mm-hmm. shuts down because you've entered into a state where you've released that because of some outside influence on your body, which I believe is stress induced, and your body goes into
Do you play music?
I do.
You do. Okay, what do you play?
Drums.
I play drums too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really weird.
I used to be a professional drummer, but
really? Oh, okay.
That's another story.
All right. Well, that shoots that theory out. Anyway, so
you enter the survival level. When you enter the survival level, all of a sudden you start pulling information from other areas.
Right. Right. So that actually makes sense with what I say. That doesn't contradict it at all.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that our conscience is actually a risk manager. And just to put it in perspective, nature has a cheap risk manager, which is jealousy. When an animal looks at another animal and says, why does that animal have all that stuff that I don't have? And gets jealous. And, of course, humans do this, too.
Well,
we do everything
thing, yeah.
that the animal kingdom does. Yeah. Right? That's not a deep thought. That's envy is a very superficial kind of, you know. And so that's the cheap conscience. And that gives you an idea of what a conscience is, what a risk manager mm-hmm. is. So we have a more expensive, more complex risk manager, which is that we compare on, like, emotional experiences. Mm-hmm. And we kind of glue them together to form a new picture of things, something we've never seen before, right? So this thing has the attributes of this, 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 and this, and those things together make this decision pattern, right?
Right.
So it's to put it in computer terms, it's almost like it's a relational database mm-hmm. that sits on top of our thoughts, right? So if that's true, then we have a way that we can view risk and thoughts. We have a way that we can view events and come up with new abstract ideas. This is where the imagination comes from. And that what we're doing is we're actually doing what we naturally do, which is processing future risk. And that when we use linguistic shifts, like when we shift our lexicon, when we're changing the words that we use to talk about things, that we're actually, those shifts are how we're communicating to each other, our SETI at home style background supercomputer in our conscience. Mm-hmm. And then we're actually solving the problems of what's going to happen next in a way that our rational minds can't keep up with.
Right.
So this is a completely down-to-earth, straight, hard science, plausible, you know, it's a theory, but hard science plausible group of theories as to how people are making successful psychic predictions. So,
they may actually be doing psychic predictions, though.
They may be. And of course, I could still be right, and that doesn't discount that at all.
Right.
It just means that I've identified one mechanism by which this happens.
Now, what's really interesting is the imagination section of the brain is the same. It's the same part. You lost your bottom.
I went out.
It's the same part of your brain that is used to channel information from, you know, the center of the galaxy or wherever universal information comes
from. Right. So I'm just describing a terrestrial, very down-to-earth mechanism. Right. It doesn't rule out a celestial antenna.
Right.
You know, it's just one piece, this one possible way. So with that in mind, I've been following this thing called the WebBots for a couple of decades, and
they've been making some interesting predictions.
They've made some spectacular predictions. It's really Cliff High. That's he's the core. He's a programmer.
Yeah.
And they're. I'm even more interested in when they fail, when his predictions fail, and why it was wrong than why it was right. But
it comes back to, you know, if I'm
the least influence on that. When it comes to the people space, you know, this person's going to do this thing at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things is, there's a couple of things that happen. One is you can change the outcome. And the other one is it's almost impossible to tell the dates and the times that things are going to happen. You end up coming with kind of a flexible ruler of temporal dates.
Right.
Right. This happens, then this happens, and this happens, and this happens. And sometimes you'll miss one. And you'll jump an event because the event has changed.
But it's hard to predict if
there's a Heisenberg kind of effect.
Because we're so fluid and we're unpredictable.
Right. But if you use the temporal marker system and you exclude dates, mm-hmm. it's pretty damn good.
Right.
It's compelling for those that are interested. If you're not interested, nothing's going to make you interested. But I just wanted to, the longest disclaimer in history, but I wanted to throw that disclaimer out there so that if anybody looks at this later and they go, well, why are you entertaining the possibility of UFOs, you know, and aliens, you know?
Why are you not entertaining it?
Well, here's another thing for you. Is there any difference between, you know, if we're in a simulation or if there's aliens?
Right.
Or if there's a higher being, as in most people worship as a deity, they're all in the same space.
Well, that's the problem. Is that
you know,
that's exactly why the
you can
the
agree
happen.
With all three of them being possible, or you can deny all three of them. But it's really hard to do both.
Well, that's exactly.
And most conventional scientists, including atheists, say, "Oh, well, aliens are possible." Okay. Well, guess what? Tour bus you're on.
Right.
You're going straight to Arizona on that tour bus.
I was looking for a picture that I can't seem to find over here. But that's one of the reasons why the aliens haven't made contacts, because they don't want to be treated as deities. At least the benevolent ones.
So basically, we're stewing in our own nuclear waste because humans act too much like groupies.
Well, they want to give away their power. You know, if some alien walks in, oh my God, they're God, right? And I'm giving away my power to them instead of saying,
right,
they're my equal. They're just more. It's just like a college.
Well, we're going to stop solving things at that point.
It's a college professor versus a kid in kindergarten, right? They're
right.
God because look what they can do and I can't.
Right.
And they're no different than you if you put the work in to study it.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you just have to look at the Old Testament, look at Genesis. You know, everyone's like, oh, come on, flaming swords. No, or, yeah, well, that looks stupid and you're in the year 1 AD.
Go look.
Lightsabers. Right? Seriously, right?
Go watch Ancient Aliens. It was aliens. You know,
right.
I love that show because everything is like aliens.
Right, right.
You know, they're the other extreme.
Or it's a simulation, like Musk's favorite. You know, you can't tell. You see, it actually, you have to reach a level of maturity to say, I don't know.
Right.
Right? You know, and I think maybe that's what they're waiting for. Maybe they're waiting for a point where people are actually willing to say,
well, it's
that's impossible. You're being ridiculous. You're a goofy person.
Right.
Versus, I don't know.
It's personal growth.
I don't know.
It's,
beat me up. I don't know. I'm going to get a t-shirt. I don't know. Somebody can beat me up. So, anything else you want to close with?
Or? I'll close with a quick story if you want.
Yeah, yeah, go for it.
So we hired this programmer in Florida to do some work for us a few years ago.
Right.
So he calls us up one day. So I couldn't do any work because the air conditioner broke in my house. I couldn't do any work because I'm in a hotel and there's no internet service. And the best one was, I couldn't do any work because my house is haunted and the Ghostbuster guys are coming to check it out. You can't make this stuff up.
Wow, really? Where was this?
It was somewhere in Florida. I mean, we were just like roaring because this guy came with so many excuses on why he couldn't do the work.
Wow.
It was incredible.
That's awesome. All right, well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Rich Sienna, look him up at, what is it, Rich Sienna?
RichardSienna.com.
RichardSienna.com.
One N.
Thanks so much for hanging with us, and we'll see you next week, next Thursday, 8 p.m. sharp. Good night.